Welcome to the July 28th meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. If you would, please all rise and join me in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, the changes to today's agenda, please.
We have an amended item to consent, A1, a letter transmitting plans and specifications for Oroville Avenue Cooperative Road Improvements in Cambria, contract number 300374, and submittal of a resolution approving an internal loan from the general fund and corresponding budget adjustment in the amount of $90,000 to the County Service Area Number 2, 2nd District. Recommend approval and instruct clerk to give notice of bid opening date set for August 27, 2009 at 3 o'clock. Staff is recommending the cover sheet be amended to correct County Service Area Number 2 to read County Service Area Number 21. We have B1, which is a presentation of 30-year service award resolutions. Recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign same. Staff is recommending this item be amended by replacing the attachment to add Tim Huntington. The replacement page is attached for your approval. We have a withdrawn item hearing, which is C3, a hearing to consider an appeal by Marilyn Farmer of the Planning Commission's approval of a conditional use permit, DRC 2007-00135, Sanjay Kampule, for the construction of a 24,800-square-foot medical office, parking area, landscaping, and associated improvements located at 1310 Las Tablas in Templeton, 1st District. Recommend denial of this appeal. Staff is recommending this item be withdrawn due to an error in the noticing requirements. This item will be heard on August 18, 2009. We have an added items to closed session. It's conference with real property negotiator. It is the intention of the board to meet in closed session to have a conference with its real property negotiator concerning the following: property description at 604 Main Street in Cambria, California. Parties with room negotiating: Rodney Paula. Instructions to negotiator: price, terms, and conditions. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied, as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. That brings us to our consent agenda. I have no request to speak, and seeing no one coming forward, we'll close it to the public. Bring it back to the board for any colleagues who would like to pull items. Mr. Meacham?
No, sir.
Mr. Patterson?
No, sir.
Mr. Sajjan?
No, sir.
Mr. Hill?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have one. Madam Clerk, we will need to pull A4 and continue it until next week. There was a slight confusion on the noticing of that as well, although it's not a formally noticed item. Organization bringing that resolution, this is on the Rigetti Ranch Conservation Easement, the organization who's bringing that resolution forward sent out letters suggesting it was going to be acted on next week. So we will go ahead and pull that, and I would entertain a motion on consent as amended.
Approval.
We have various supervisors interested. I would call it Mr. Patterson with Mr. Shajian on the second, and we'll take a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. With that, we come to our presentation calendar. I'd entertain a motion on that.
So moved.
Second.
That would be Mr. Shajian and Mr. Patterson. And another roll call, please.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. So we'll invite Ms. Douglas Schatz and Ms. Duke to start off our celebration of a lot of years of service to this county.
Good morning.
morning, Mr. Chair, Board of Supervisors. I'm Tammy Douglas-Schatz from the Human Resources Department, and here to assist me today to celebrate 30-year service awards is Dory Duke, also from Human Resources. We are happy to be here to assist the board in your tradition of recognizing employees for their years of public service. Individuals recognized by the board are dedicated employees who serve as an example to others as they contribute on a daily basis to the county's vision of a safe, healthy, livable, prosperous, and well-governed community. So we have five 30-year awards today, and those of you receiving awards, the board members will be reading resolutions for you today. So if you would, when your name is called, come up, and you'll hear your resolution read, get an award, and approach the board, shake hands, and today, because it's a 30-year award day, the board is inviting you to make comments if you wish. So with that, we'll go ahead and get started. Our first honoree today is Kimberly Johnson from the Air Pollution Control District.
Thank you. It gives me a great pleasure to read this resolution of the Board of Supervisors honoring Kimberly Johnson for her 30 years of exemplary public service. Whereas Kim Johnson was still in her teens when she began work as an administrative assistant at the Air Pollution Control District just a few years after the agency was formed. And whereas when Kim first started, she took shorthand and dictation, was a whiz on the typewriter, and handled all clerical responsibilities for the other three district staff, including deciphering and transcribing the unintelligible handwriting of the previous director, not to be confused with Mr. Allen. Whereas, through the years, Kim has mastered technology changes and now oversees three of her own staff, manages all clerical support for 24 district staff, coordinates all meetings and agendas for a 12-member independent board, and is a vital member of the Air Pollution Control District management team. And whereas, despite the significant growth in her responsibilities over the years, Kim has always been able to accomplish everything asked of her in a highly professional and efficient manner, and still manages to complete the Tribune's crossword puzzle each day during lunch. No secrets left untold for Kim. Whereas Kim's institutional knowledge, attention to detail, strong work ethic, and ability to see the big picture are key factors in the smooth operation of the district, and whereas Kim's great sense of humor, quick wit, and telltale rolling of her eyes can instantly lighten any meeting and keep things in perspective. And whereas Kim is the glue that holds the district together and helps make it such a meaningful and enjoyable place to work. Now, therefore, be it resolved and ordered that the County of San Luis Obispo Board of Supervisors does hereby recognize and commend Kimberly Johnson for 30 years of exemplary public service to the residents of our county and to the mission of the Air Pollution Control District.
Hey, paparazzi now want
many cameras.
Yeah, the formal the formal portrait. Okay, you can open that up if you want to. Don't check his and just give it to
Thank you.
Did you want to say a few words to Larry or Kim? Either way?
Kim.
Well, I would just briefly, Larry Allen, Director of the Air Pollution Control District, I'd just like to say that Kim is really what keeps us going at the district, and she had better not retire before I do, because I don't think I could take the change. She was instrumental for Bob Carr. She's instrumental for me as just a key person on the staff. She holds our finances together. She knows all the skeletons in the closet. They're not very many, but she's just a great person, has a great wit, and we're really fortunate to have her. And we all notice when she's on vacation or when she's out for just a few days because things just don't run as smooth. So, Kim, thank you so much for all of your dedication, all of your years of service to the district. You deserve this.
Okay, next we'll honor Patricia LaRose from Social Services.
My pleasure to read a resolution commending Patricia LaRose. Whereas Patricia, also known as Patty LaRose, has worked for the County of San Luis Obispo without interruptions since April 29, 1979, encompassing 30 years of employment. And whereas Patty LaRose began her employment as a correctional officer in the Sheriff's Department in 1979 and transferred to the Department of Social Services in 1984, and whereas at the Department of Social Services, Patty has held the position of intermediate typist clerk, easier to spell than to say, was promoted to account clerk in 1985, was promoted to senior account clerk in 1988, was promoted to accounting technician in 1995 and was promoted to supervising accounting technician in 1999. And whereas Patty has maintained an exemplary attendance record during her employment, and whereas Patty has been responsible for many aspects of Department of Social Services accounting over the years, including food stamp reconciliation and reporting, budget and expenditure monitoring, accounts payable, accounts receivable, travel accounting, and many other duties as assigned, and whereas Patty currently oversees the county expense claiming unit that is responsible for obtaining reimbursement for state-mandated social services programs, generating approximately $50 million per year in reimbursement revenues to San Luis Obispo County, and whereas Patty is the congregate care supervisor for the county's emergency response plan, and whereas Patty is known for her dedication to the county and the community, and displays enthusiasm for taking on any challenges that are presented to her in her position, therefore be it resolved and ordered by the Board of Supervisors, County of San Luis Obispo, State of California, that Patty LaRose hereby is commended for her 30 years of dedication to the county mission, and be it also resolved that Patty is wished the best of health, happiness, and good future fortune in her continued service and beyond. And then if you'd like to offer us any comments here.
Director of the Department of Social Services. Patty is our rainmaker, as you noted, Mr. Chairman. She does do the processes that bring in $50 million a year of federal and state funds into our community. And that's important, but I think what she would agree is most important is that she was recently certified as a conductor and fireman for a narrow-gauge steam train, and I think that she's very proud of that.
Next, we'd like to honor Daniel Mannion from Public Works.
Yes, Mr. Mannion.
I do it? I was expecting
you. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Ashanjan, please, would you
thank you, Mr. Chair. It gives me great honor to read this resolution recognizing Daniel for 30 years of service to residents of the County of San Luis Obispo. And I was noticing among five of you, we have 150 years of service. That says a lot. Whereas Dan, after obtaining his Bachelor of Science degree in geology, entered employment with the County Engineering Department on May 21st, 1979, as a senior engineering aide and began work as chairman. Was that in Texas County Jail? As chairman on the county survey crew because he is not irritated by poison oak. And whereas Dan has successfully progressed through the department's professional development series, during which time he obtained his professional license as a land surveyor and is currently the deputy county surveyor. And whereas Dan has continually managed the county's city limit and special district boundaries. Monument Preservation Program, and is a team leader for the Department of Public Works Storm Watch Program, aiding county residents in times of natural disasters. And whereas, Dan has surveyed numerous areas within the county, including the riverfront boundary of Lake Santa Margarita, portions of Cayucas, Nipomo, Avila Valley, California Valley, the Lopez Dam Monitoring Program, and several capital improvement construction projects. And whereas Dan's interests lay in music, whereby he and his wife are both accomplished musicians, historical maps and mapping, volunteering as a hiking docent for the Port St. Louis Lighthouse, bicycling as his preferred mode of commuting. And whereas his dedication to the needs of his community have been recognized by his peers in the professional community and by the California Land Surveyors Association, where he donates his time to instruct licensing classes for aspiring surveyors. Now, therefore, be it resolved and ordered that the County of San Luis Obispo Board of Supervisors, State of California, does hereby recognize 30 years of outstanding public service provided by Dan Mannion to the residents of our county. Congratulations.
Yes, this recognition is very much appreciated. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
If I may, Dan is the expert surveyor in the county. Anybody, any of the private surveyors that need help or have a question about a survey technique, they come to Dan. There's always, has been in my tenure with the county, you know, one person in the county who has the all the knowledge of surveying and the laws. For Dan, it was Jim Grandflatten. Now it's Dan. I don't know who Dan's going to pass it on to because I'm going to be gone. So. But we do appreciate Dan and his knowledge and his professionalism. Thanks.
Our next honoree is Leandro Villalone from the Probation Department.
Good morning, and it is my honor to present this resolution of the Board of Supervisors of San Francisco County recognizing Leandro Villalone for his 30 years of service. Leandro Villalone began his employment with the County of San Luis Obispo on May 29, 1979 in the General Services Agency. Leandro transferred, he wasn't given, put in probation, but he was transferred to probation. Department as an account clerk in November of 1992. Leandro was promoted to a juvenile services officer in January of 97, and then Leandro was promoted to the juvenile services officer 2 in December of 1997. Whereas Leandro was promoted to a juvenile services officer 3 in February 1999, and in January 2002, Leandro received a special commendation for his efforts in saving the life of an unconscious minor detained at the juvenile hall who had attempted suicide. And Leandro received a letter of recognition from his supervisor, Gary Hopkinson, on the use of pervasive and creative verbal skills to prevent a use of force situation when handling a difficult situation with a minor. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors of the County of San Luis Obispo, State of California, hereby recognizes Leandro Villalone for his 30 years of dedicated service to the county and commends him for his valuable contribution to making our community a safer place. Thank you, sir.
Sure, sure, yeah. That'd be great. Come. Let's get the family, yeah?
Yeah. This will improve the picture, I noticed.
Yeah, maybe you could take the camera from...
You want to center yourself?
There we go.
Thank you, Board, for having us here this morning. I really appreciate this. This is an honor. And my family, of course, and my wife, who's also a county employee. She's got 31 years of service herself. I really appreciate them being here. I appreciate Robert Reyes and Kim's here, and Ed Leipscher, whom I've worked for many years and really enjoyed working at the juvenile hall. And thank Jim Salio as well.
Jim Salio, Chief Probation Officer. Leandro exemplifies everything that's right with a county employee, with a government employee. Leandro works selfishly at the juvenile hall, dedicating his time to working with at-risk youth. He always has a smile on his face. He's just a great guy to be around. Thank you, Leandro.
And next, we'll honor Robert Yetter of the General Services Agency Parks Department.
My pleasure to read this resolution. Whereas Bob Yetter has given the county 30 years of dedicated and excellent service while working for General Services Agency County Parks, whereas Bob, by his competence and ability, has been an important part of the Parks program and has been promoted to increasingly responsible positions within the division to his present position of Park Ranger Specialist, and whereas Bob has served the public with intelligence and tact and is known to be one of the Park Division's most competent rangers in the area of visitor services, and whereas Bob has shown great skill and ability in training new staff and is always helpful and patient in the orientation process, and whereas Bob, because of his experience, has been a major contributor to the planning for the soon-to-be-implemented Parks Reservation and Accounting System, which will give the public greater flexibility and ease in making park reservations. And whereas Bob has been an outstanding public employee and has always given calm, reliable, intelligent service to the county, now therefore be it resolved and ordered by the Board of Supervisors of San Luis Obispo County that Bob Yetter be and hereby is commended for 30 years of dedicated and devoted service, and sincere thanks for a job well done.
I thought we had a retirement ceremony.
Who is this guy?
You're welcome. Oh, did I say that out loud? Thank you very much for the recognition, 30 years. I can't believe it's been 30 years already. Just thinking back while I was sitting there, that 30 years on the job, I've been married to the same wonderful woman, Chris, who happens to be in Wisconsin right now on business and can't join us, but for 27 years, lived in the same house for 25 years, drive the same car 22 years. But yet, I work in a job where it changes daily. And so I find that a little ironic, but I find pleasure in that. As park rangers, we wear many hats, visitor services, administrative duties, medical response, fire response, quite a variety of things, and it changes hourly sometimes. And I think that's the one aspect of the job that I like the most, is that it's the change involved in that. So I'd also like to thank all of other park rangers that are here and staff in the General Services Agency. It's been fun working with them, a bunch of dedicated professionals, and work hard for the public and ensure safety and protection of the resources that we have in our parks. So there are, I think there were four people that that retired this year that had 30 plus years of work with the county. So it seems like that once we get a job in the park system here in the county, that we hang on to our jobs. But and also I'd like to thank Pete for his service to the county. He's well, was to retire on Independence Day, which everyone thought was appropriate, but he's back again for a short period, I guess. But under his guidance, the park system's really flourished, and the employees in the system have appreciated his leadership. So thank you.
Pete Jenny, semi-retired Parks Deputy Director. I can't get away or let Bob get away. He spoke very eloquently for himself, but just to let you all know, and by the way, I confirmed, 30 years on service, he was actually 8 when he started working as a park ranger. When I got here a little over 19 years ago, he was one of those young rising stars that, one of the really sharp people that made me know that I had come to the right place. Here 30 years or 20 years later, he's still one of our bright, not quite so young rangers, but the type of people that I think this community should be proud of, the type of people who are quietly going about their jobs, setting the table for people to go out and have a good time and make people's lives better, only there when we really need them. And if you go down, if you have an accident, there's no better person than Bob to come and make sure that you're well cared for. If you just want to go out and have a good time, no better person who's taking care of the resource than Bob and the people he works with. So congratulations, and wish you all the best. And the truth be known, I'm getting out before all the really good people are gone, because I don't want to have to worry about working without guys like Bob. Thank you.
Thank you, and on behalf of the board, thanks again to all the recipients. I'm struck not only with the 150 years of service, but also the variety of work that all you all do and the dedication with which you do it. So be well, thanks again, and we'll look for you in five more for a 35-year. That brings us to public comment items not on the agenda. If there are any other requests to speak, I need to see them right now. Seeing none, we have one, two, three coming forward. While we do that, is that Los Osos, Ms. Galassa? No, it's 3 minutes apiece if it's Los Osos. We got Elon on the sewer. All right.
Yeah.
Just give us a slip if you want to speak on Los Osos. So,
I hear one already.
He won't tell me. He won't tell me.
Are you speaking on Los Osos?
If I don't get 3 minutes.
She will get 3 minutes. Are you wanting to speak? Okay, great. Thank you. All right, we have all the requests to speak then. If I could ask Mr. Andrews or someone in the back if they could close the back door. Thank you. We'll take public comment items not on the agenda. We'll start with Eric Greening, followed by Dr. David Thomas Harrell.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and it's always wonderful to see just what true public service is, and so many of the people who work for us here in the county exemplify it. The contrast with what's happening in Sacramento is quite a come down, but in any event, we presumably again have a budget. We actually did have a budget in February, but presumably we again have a budget for a while, and the consequences are horrific, but not quite as horrific as they might have been. The two pieces of good news floating among the catastrophe is, number one, they did not override the State Lands Commission, set a terrible precedent for offshore oil drilling illegally, and number two, they did not steal the gas tax money. And one reason that it's important to note the latter is we do actually now have a way to keep the needed people who are keeping up the roads working to do just that. It means that that is being funded from the appropriate source. Meanwhile, the legislature continues its utter defiance of the law relative to state transit assistance, the spillover account, relative to the funding for public transit. In the face of an appellate court decision, they simply said, well, let's let it go to the Supreme Court, and made not one gesture to replace the billions stolen from public transit, nor to begin remedying what is clearly a breach of the law. What this means is we need to make sure that TDA goes to all transit needs to keep the service whole before it goes to road maintenance, which does have a proper funding source. This is a particularly urgent issue because in the RTA there is, as I understand it, a strike vote called for the day after tomorrow. The RTA board for next Wednesday that I thought was going to occur has evidently been canceled. You being 5/8 of that board, I figure I should let you know that you might need to be called into emergency session depending how the strike vote goes, and do what you can to keep the system whole and keep people compensated as they were promised to be compensated. I have not seen in writing what would be asked for in the event that this happens, but please be prepared. Do all you can to keep the people working and the people who do not have cars able to circulate in this county. This is essential, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Dr. Harrell, followed by Dan Duvall. Straight to the center, Dr. Harrell, and I think we should have a mic on right there.
Is this mic working?
No, try it.
The one that's right above
Mr. Grant, could you bring the gooseneck?
Yep.
Yeah, let's bring that down right where we can get at it here.
We'll get it for you.
And we have to ask AV to get the...
It was on.
Thank you very much. Good morning, County Board of Supervisors and Members. As the former speaker said, you know, I commend all of you and everyone in the county. Most of the county employees on all the agencies are very hardworking, good people, and are working for the benefit of the people. Unfortunately, there is a huge, systemic, pervasive amount of problems here in the county regarding access to agencies, as you know, access to assistance with peoples of all levels of economic stratus and whatnot, for assistance of all types, and especially medical assistance. That's a real large problem here in the community. I myself was four times this last week taken twice by ambulance to French Hospital and was unable to receive any adequate medical care whatsoever. Any adequate diagnostic, as I don't know if you're aware, they have no capacity for fMRI, PET scans, things like that. It's very lacking. The problem is, there's a great deal, also part of the problem, is that there's a great deal of bias and discrimination and abuse and harm to our citizens here by employees of different agencies. I myself, yesterday, in a medical emergency during an ambulance arrived and whatnot, I was assaulted by a fire department employee. These things, you know, a lot of people in the community, this is not myself, I have a huge list of many, many citizens here that have suffered harm, had their civil and constitutional rights violated grossly. I myself am going to circulate a petition to all, try to get it to every citizen in the county, listing what problems have you had at accessing medical programs, services, etc. How do you see these being remedied and whatnot? And we're going to compile this, get it to, I'm working with Mr. Blakesley's office and whatnot, we're going to get it to Governor Schwarzenegger and Washington, D.C. forthwith. Hugely problematic is access to adequate medical care here. This is a pervasive national problem, of course, and but we need to address this specifically here in this county. I suffered a huge amount of violation of my patient's civil rights, constitutional rights in the hospital by hospital employees. Horrific. Unfortunate.
Dr. Harrell, I'm afraid your time is up.
Okay. Very good. In closing, I'll assist citizens to file federal actions.
Okay.
We can solve this, ignore it, and solve, do it, or do it the hard way.
Thank you for your comment, sir. Mr. Duvall, followed by Jimmy Lack.
Thank you, Chairman Gibson and Board of Supervisors. The fight is over. Lead follower, get the hell out of the way. And authority prevails, and I'm turning the people, the 40 people that are at Sunny Acres, into your care. I want the county to come out there and get those people and take better care of them than I'm taking care of them, because I cannot take care of them to your standards. It was my goal to take care of these people without public funds, which I have done. It was my desire to give them better than they had. I have done that. But I have not come up to your standards. I am tired of having these people in the middle of a fight. Your staff gets all suited up with their thug boots, their flak jackets, their guns, to come out and take two water samples. They call me the following day and they ask me if they can come out and take another water sample, which they could have done the first day. And I was inclined to tell them, if you have so much fun suiting up in your thug boots, your flak jackets, go get another search warrant. What are you trying to prove? But instead, don't come on out. They'll be out 10 o'clock this morning. There won't be any trouble. There won't be any stress on my clients. And as I have announced, I want you people to come out and take better care of those people than I've given them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Duvall. Mr. Lack, followed by Hope Garcia.
Yes. My name is Jimmy Lack, and I've lived at Sunny Acres since 2002. I've spoke before you all several times over the years. I came there in a wheelchair, and I can walk. I make all my doctor's appointments there. I have a roof over my head. It's not a shotgun shack. The man has saved my life. So my parents are talking to me now, and most of the town of Royal Grande is talking to me. I can talk to John Spencer and go anywhere I want, and I'm welcome. Now I'm about to lose my home, and I'm handicapped, and there's no way I can, 3 hours and you got to be out of the building. I need some kind, I pay my rent for the past 5 years on time, and I pay a reasonable amount of money for rent, and I get more than what I pay for. I'm well taken care of. I get three meals a day. I get escorted to my meals. I get checked on day and night to make sure that I'm okay because I'm not in good health. I'm coming up on my three-year anniversary without a drink of liquor. And Mr. Cottrell knows that. He's seen me the other side of me. And this place has done nothing but good for me. Now, if y'all going to come along and supposed to be the United States of America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, well, you know, I fought for my country. At least give me a chance to, you know, I don't want a three-day eviction notice or I don't know legalities and stuff. I bumped my head too many times. But I need quite a bit of time to relocate myself if I have to leave, which I don't plan on leaving at all, because I call that my home. And I've been through this fight with you guys. I would like congratulations to the people who got merits of award today. I would love to come in here on a happy note and get something like my father has done in the past in Arroyo Grande for helping out the Girl Scouts, the Boys Club, the DARE program, kids with cancer and all that. My family donates to all of that. And there isn't a grocery store in this county that my father doesn't have anything to do with, but he's up in age, and I'm about to lose him, and I need to stay as close as possible. And the Duval Ranch, Sunny Acres, is put to me where I could speak with my family now. And I run the meeting for AA and for NA. I mean, what more do you want? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lack. Ms. Garcia, followed by Maria Garcia. We could have the next speaker approaching the other lectern. That would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Gibson and the Board of Supervisors. I appreciate this opportunity to talk to you. My name is Hope Garcia, and come August, if I'm still able to live at Sunny Acres, I'll have been there a year. Now, Dan Duvall and Sunny Acres helped me retain my job off the property, which I lost at the end of June due to a closing of the warehouse. It had nothing to do with my inability to perform the job they had hired me for. I have been able to be sober for the entire length of time I've been there, and they provide us meals, they provide us structure, they provide us volunteer service to help with the community, to help reestablish our self-confidence, and to rebuild our lives. Without the foundation that Sunny Acre provides us, we would still be in a worse place than where we were when he found us. I came to Sunny Acres because I had nowhere to go. I was steps away from being kicked out of Maxine Lewis's overnight shelter, never to return, because I could not handle the transitional necessity of that establishment. The fact that you clean up every day and come back with the hopes that you will have a bed available to you, but it may not be the same one. You have to be in by 6 and you have to be out by 7. So it was difficult for me to wrap my head around the fact that I was homeless, that I was broke, that through some fault of my own, but not completely my own, I had ended up homeless again. I have lived in San Luis for 10 years, and I have been homeless probably 7 of those 10 years. I have nowhere else to go. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Garcia. Ms. Maria Garcia, followed by Matt Ingham.
Hi. I came from Sacramento. I had to come live in Santa Maria first because my husband's on parole, so I had to follow him. Which we were homeless, the first night we got into Santa Maria, we stood in a box because we had nowhere to go, you know, and we were living in a shelter over there, and then we decided for us to leave, so we came over here to SLO. This is the first time I've ever been in this city. And my husband looked for work, they looked for work, and no doors were open because he's on parole. You know, or they judge him by the way he looks because he has a bunch of tattoos and his prison record, you know, and there was nowhere to go. And I was like, God, there's got to be somewhere. There's got to be somebody that gives us a chance. And out of nowhere, this woman came up to us in a store, and he told us about Dan. Call him. That's all she told us, call him. You know, we called him, you know, without no hesitations. He told us, come on over. That same day we were in, I couldn't believe it, you know. He didn't look at my husband like, wow, you know what, this is a criminal or whatever, or he's, look at all the tattoos you have, you know. He didn't look at the color of our skin. He took us in the way we were, you know, and he gave us a chance. He gave us a place to live. He gave us pride, dignity. My husband loves, I mean, he's a hard worker. You know, he just, man, he feel, his favorite word is, I'm a human being, you know, and that's what we are. We're human beings, you know. Well, yes, we've made mistakes in our past, but Sandoval, he's been wonderful, you know. He's opened the doors, you know. He's gone through all this for us, you know, and I don't call it a sober living, I call it a home. That's the first place I really have felt loved and wanted, and I don't know, it's just like, man, I don't want that to be taken from us, because it's like the beginning for us. It's been a beginning for me and my husband to start a new life. You know, God bless you.
Thank you, Ms. Garcia. Mr. Ingham, followed by Andrew Kirk.
Hi, my name is Matt Ingham, and my story is very similar to some of the previous speakers. I came to Sunny Acres with, you know, nowhere else to really go. And, you know, I just want to speak about, you know, the kindness that Dan shows us there at the ranch, you know. And as Maria was saying, the unbiased, services that he does provide. And I just think that it would be... it would have somewhat of a negative impact on the community if Sunny Acres was closed. And I just wanted to support Dan, you know, and everything that he's doing over there, because I really believe in what he's doing. And again, I think it would be a negative thing if Sunny Acres had to close, if it had to close, you know, in any situation. But it would be even more of a shame if it was, you know, caused to close because of some code violations, you know. And if there was any type of suggestion that I could come up with, it would be maybe, maybe some sort of compromise or something like that. I mean, I don't even know if that would be a possibility, but I just think that it would be a real shame if Sunny Acres was shut down for any reason, you know, because I think that Dan does provide a really great service to the community, and you know, and there's not a lot of places out there like Sunny Acres, you know, as the other speakers were talking about, you know, that are willing to, you know, in my personal case, I struggle with some mental issues, you know, and you know, Sunny Acres has been really patient with me. I can't say for sure that other places wouldn't have been as patient, but I do know that there were some times there where, I don't know if I was in a leadership position in a place such as Sunny Acres, I don't know if I would have had the patience to deal with me, but Dan did have the patience to deal with me and, gave me the time that I needed to, and now I'm doing good, you know, and that's 100% hugely dependent, caused by the help that Dan and his staff has given me. You know, and Dan and his staff have helped me greatly with my illness and with my rehabilitation and, helping me to get on the road to becoming a productive member of society, which I'm sure is something that the county would want. And if Sunny Acres does get shut down, they're going to lose a facility that is helping that happen. And that's pretty much all I have to say, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Ingham. Andrew Kirk, followed by Darcene Clayton.
My name is Andrew Kirk, and first I'd like to say it's a real pleasure seeing people receive a recognition for their hard work, as your county workers did today. that there are so many unsung heroes, the people that don't get rewarded for their efforts, and Mr. Duvall is one of those heroes. He's a teacher, a visionary. He works endlessly and at no cost to anybody. He does this out of his own pocket. I've been there for 5 months. I struggle with alcohol problem. I got 5 months clean and sober at Dan DeVault's. I've been arrested over 50 times for drunk in public, but I'm sober now. Mr. Duvall is the cause of that. He gave me a place to live, let me move in without paying any money, because I had no money. He allowed me to work, to give me my self-esteem back. It's a little difficult to talk. Mr. Duvall, he's probably worth a lot of money, and he finances this out of his own pocket. And the county, that by their own accounting, collects over $50 million a year. 2 weeks ago in the paper, and the City News published an article saying they formed a new homeless oversight committee and funded it with $360,000. It would seem that's a very small amount of money to apply to this problem that's growing exponentially because of foreclosures and the lack of jobs. And with over 10,000 jobs lost in this county in the last year, it would seem that maybe a little more money could be earmarked for people that are becoming homeless. Instead of working against this man because of selective enforcement of laws, we look the other way on a lot of laws, such as illegal immigration, which is undercutting the labor market for menial jobs. And there are no jobs available. If you pick up a local paper, you will see, under Help Wanted, there's just nothing. There's no low-cost housing anywhere. The county provides low-cost housing for people with mental problems. But if you don't have a mental problem, there is no low-cost housing. And to appropriate $360,000 to deal with a problem that's going to take billions of dollars is laughable. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Kirk. Ms. Clayton, followed by Ryan Galassa.
Good afternoon. Thank you for allowing me to speak on this. Mr. Duvall, I'd like to thank you for helping me stay continuing clean and sober. The county continues to come out and terrorize we, the people. And it was very terrorizing sitting there with those people and the guns under the hot sun. I don't care how nice they were. They were doing their job, and you were the ones telling them to do it, to come out and do that. You're using us, the people that are homeless, that are ill, to get your way. And we know what this is about, regardless of if Dan Duvall were to clean up every single issue there was, cars, truck, whatever it was. That isn't what this is about. You want his land, and you will never allow Sunny Acres to build to continue and to continue to survive there. And I know that, and you know that, and a lot of other people know that. It's about that. It's about the money. These people, those park rangers who just left here, those are some of the resources and some of the very people that this is going to be affecting, because we're going to be sleeping in the parks now. We're going to be using the bathrooms there. Where else is there going to be? Now, what I want to know, my bag is going to be packed Saturday. Mr. Gibson, is it your house I'm going to go stay at? Yours? Who's home? Are you going to invite me in? Me and my cats to live at. If I'm ready, I'm a wonderful client. I keep things clean, take care of business, clean and sober. Is it your house that you invite me in to stay on your property? I don't think so. Mr. Duvall has opened his home and his land to us and to many others. And you're using us, the people. And that's wrong, and shame on every one of you for that. You guys are incapable of taking care of the homeless. You're incapable. We don't have the funds. Here in a time of desperate economical, you should really be spending your money somewhere else and helping the people. Where are we going to? There's 40 of us out there. There's 4,000 of us on the street. You can't handle, you can't take care of those. These people choose to come there to change their lives, and you've heard their stories and their testimony of being clean and sober and changing. You're going to take that from them? He's been successful at what he's done. What have you done lately? Thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you, Ms. Clayton. Ms. Galassa, followed by Alon Perlman.
I'm sorry to change the subject to Los Osos. Brian Galassa, Los Osos. For over 25 years, Los Osos has resembled a giant chess game with many players vying for control of the PZ. This beginning with the county and the water board back in the 80s. The people who actually live in the PZ continue to be pawns in this game. Different players try to manipulate us to their advantage, but the bottom line is that we are expendable. Mr. Gibson, you warn the pawns to hurry the Planning Commission or we will lose out on stimulus funding. But if Mr. Okren has spent his time developing a real environmentally preferred project instead of pleasing his preferred players, we would not have had these delays. The Planning Commission has been working hard to fix this mess that has been created in Los Osos over the last 25 years and is now experiencing personal attacks for their efforts. It is time this board stand up and give them your support. Instead of allowing your staff to undermine the Planning Commission and questioning Peter Douglas's comprehension skills, instead I would advise you to take a step back, look at the big picture, see how we can avoid a train wreck, and save the basin. It is time for a basin management plan in Los Osos. The Coastal Act of 1976 gave the county the responsibility to monitor water use in the basin when they first realized even a possibility of seawater intrusion. The county code 8.04.065 gives you the responsibility to protect our coastal basin from seawater intrusion by monitoring all basin wells and by limiting extraction if necessary. For 20 years, we have had a building moratorium in the prohibition zone. In the Los Osos CSD district, water usage has decreased, yet seawater intrusion is accelerating. Why? We do not have the necessary data because the county has known about the problem with seawater intrusion for a very long time, but a monitoring project was never established. The county approved 1,150 homes in the PZ under 8313, and the county continues to approve new water users over the basin. It is time to take responsibility for your actions and those of your predecessors. You must develop contingencies for the possibility of a failure of 8313, which established the PC. If 8313 fails, we still need a project in Los Osos to save the basin, and the responsibility for seawater intrusion falls directly in your laps. Number one, the county needs to establish a basin management plan that accurately monitors all water extracted by all users in the basin and to institute basin-wide conservation measures. No new water users, industrial or residential, should be allowed.
Ms. Galassa, I'm afraid your time is up. You may finish that sentence. Thank you. Mr. Perlman.
Thank you. Alon Perlman, Prohibition Zone, Los Osos. Some people in Los Osos are concerned with the Planning Commission actions. The Planning Commission is scrambling right now to meet the requirements of the Coastal Commission. The California Coastal Commission has the final say on this project. It's very unfortunate that the manner in which projects and permissions are passed from agency to agency has created a situation where county staff proceeded to design a project based on a requirement from the California Water Board and proceeded to a project that was not acceptable to the California Coastal Commission. What people in Los Osos are seeing right now is a process. It's actually not necessarily a great process, but is actually how the process should work, in which the Planning Commission of this county is correcting the project that staff has created in the EIR. This is what happens when An EIR preferred project is very different from the final project that will actually be accepted by the final permitting agency. This is what happens. There are last-minute adjustments. The EIR was simply not sufficient. Now, I don't think county staff conspired to create a bad EIR. I think county staff has proceeded in a linear fashion, solving one problem at a time, not necessarily thinking outside the box, and trying to contain a very big problem into a slightly smaller box. And I understand why they did that. And I can understand the reason behind it. Unfortunately, and I predicted this when I wrote in my own submission to the AIR, that this project will be delayed because the EIR is not planned to have been at tertiary treatments. Well, that's not necessarily the end of the world. There is a conservation program that's being suggested to the county. It's pretty much what the county might have had available at this point had it focused clearly on what it should have done in the first place. The county has to embrace its role as steward of the aquifer for the simple reason that there's simply no one else out there that can do that. And unfortunately or fortunately, big wastewater projects generate lots of water that can be reused and recharged. And I hope to continue to engage you in this process. Trust your planning commission. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Perlman. That concludes our speakers and general public comments, so we'll close it to the public. And we are ready then to proceed with our public hearings. Madam Clerk, if you would introduce item C1, please.
One is a hearing to consider a resolution vacating a portion of 7th Street, County Road Number 5183 in the community of Templeton, 1st District. Recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign.
Thank you. Mr. Andrews.
Good morning. Good morning, Chairman Gibson, members of the board. I'm Fred Andrews, rural property agent for the Public Works Department. For your The matter before you this morning is the result of a petition from the adjacent property owner to abandon a 10-foot wide section of 7th Street located at the southeast corner of the intersection of 7th Street and Main Street. That's County Road Number 5183 in the community of Templeton. The County Planning Department prepared the required conformity report, which was received by the County Planning Commission on July 12, 2007, with the determination that said abandonment, as presented today, is in conformity with the general plan. Public Works supports the vacation of said road as the area requested is unnecessary for present or prospective public use. County Council has reviewed and approved the resolution. The findings of fact is the vacation of the subject portions of the road will not impair public or private access. Vacation of subject portions of road will not affect existing traffic circulation. This vacation is in the public interest in that the county will extinguish roadway interests and allow consolidation of property boundaries. Proper postings and notices were made. No objections to the request to vacate were received. The matter was referred to and supported by the local Templeton Area Advisory Group. The Public Works Department recommends adoption of the resolution to vacate a portion of 7th Street, that's County Road Number 5183, in the community of Templeton. I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have. And in addition, the requesting owner, Mr. Molnar, is present in the audience and available for questions as well.
Thank you, Mr. Andrews. Any questions of Mr. Andrews? Seeing none, we will open it to the public. I have no request to speak and no one coming forward, so we'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board for action.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would make a motion that we adopt the attached resolution vacating a portion of 7th Street in the community of Templeton, County Road Number 5183.
I'll second.
Mr. Patterson on the second. And since we have a resolution, Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Sure. Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Asajian?
Aye.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you, sir. Ready for an introduction of item C2.
Here she comes.
C2 is a hearing to consider amending Title 19 of the County Code to provide time extensions for issuance of construction permits. All districts. Item was introduced July 21st, 2009. It's recommended approval and instruct chairperson to sign.
Thank you very much. Ms. Journey, are you staff on this today?
I'm staff on this today.
Welcome.
Well, and I think this is fairly familiar to all of you. So we brought back pretty much the same proposal that we had discussed before to extend the applications until December 31st, 2010. One thing that we did is we took a look at the number of applications that it might include, and we've got a total of about 1,200 applications that might benefit from this extension, and about 380 of them are single-family dwellings. So that gives you an idea of just the number that could be affected by this extension. And we also took a look at the fees and reduced the fees for the extensions to just the minimal processing fee of $66.50 and then $400 for the ones that require some augmentation to the code updates. So we tried to even hone in on that a little bit to make that as efficient and economical for people. So if you have any more questions for me.
Good. Questions for Ms. Journey? Seeing none, we'll open it to the public. I have one request to speak, the inimitable Mr. Jerry Bunin.
Compliment. Jerry Bunin, Government Affairs Director, Home Builders Association, and I will be brief. We support the staff recommendation. We also really appreciate the efforts of Cheryl Journey and Rick Swan to work with us on this. And to find a way so the projects that are applied for permits before the start of 08 aren't going to go away. Very nice. Both Cheryl and Rick were really pleasant to work with, very agreeable, and we thank them for that. And we hope you vote approval. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, thank you for all your kind words. And it's good to see you this morning.
I thought you might have something pleasant.
A lot of love in the room.
No other requests to speak. We'll close it to the public. Bring it back to the board for action.
That's recommendation.
Second? No, that's what I was going to suggest.
I'm sorry. I've been ignoring the light since I'm on such a roll. We have a motion for Mr. Ashajian, and I think I heard Mr. Hill second that motion. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we'll go ahead with a roll call on that.
Mr. Ashajian?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you. And brings us to our last item of the morning. Wow. I know, gentlemen. Stay calm. We're doing well today. Or do we need to take a break? I see Mr. Clemens out here for Public Works. I'm sure they're...
Let's move forward.
All right, we'll take a five-minute break while we wait for... Well, if we had staff, we could... We could... Yeah,
talk about those muscles.
Let's try it. Talk among ourselves.
The muscles taste good in a
white wine sauce, yeah. with a little bit of garlic, yes. Probably ought to mute the microphone, Madam Clerk.
Are we
muted?
Yeah.
We don't have... Are we live? Thank you. We'll reconvene. If you would introduce our last item of the morning, please.
Item D1 is a consideration of the legislative platform supporting prevention and management of invasive aquatic species. All districts recommend approval.
Mr. Hollenbeck.
Mr. Gibson.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. Enlighten us, please.
Okay, I will. Thank you. Morning, Chairman. Pardon me, I'll read from my notes on this. I usually don't like to do this, but I'll miss something otherwise. So, good morning, Chairman Gibson and members of the board. I'm John Hollenbeck, your Nacimiento Project Manager. I'm a member of the Public Works Department, and today I'm here to briefly summarize the proposed legislative platform presented as Exhibit A attached to our staff letter report regarding the invasive aquatic species known as quagga mussels and zebra mussels. Generally, these species have been in the United States since the late 1980s. Their impact on the operation and maintenance of hydraulic structures, which include dams, water treatment plants, pumping stations, cooling systems for power plants, etc., is estimated at roughly $9 billion per year. Within the past 3 years, these species have made their way into California, primarily through the Colorado River system, and quickly have spread through reservoirs in Southern California, primarily through the transportation of the Colorado River Aqueduct and other conveyances as such. Your Slo County Parks Division took an immediate and proactive approach to implement measures to inspect, decontaminate, and in some situations, reject the launching of watercraft in both Lake Lopez and also Santa Margarita Reservoir. On June 24th of last year, your board heard from the Slo County Parks and Public Works on those actions. Slo County Public Works is currently developing an initial response plan if these species make it into our water bodies. We've been engaged with Monterey County Water Resources Agency regarding Lake Nacimiento, which is located wholly within our boundaries of San Luis Obispo County. Monterey Agency, however, is the water system operator of Lake Nacimiento. Lake Nacimiento is also the source of our Nacimiento Water Project water. An overview of the cooperative efforts from both agencies is bulleted within the staff letter report for this agenda item. Monterey Agency provided a letter in support of today's legislative platform and action, and also provided clarifications on points of business within our staff report that are presented within the, and I will be happy to respond to questions you might have in regards to their clarifications. These comments, however, we do not believe impact or affect the recommended action. Challenges that face Monterey Agency is that Lake Nacimiento has multiple ports of entry, mainly private, with a couple public, into their water body, but that is very similar to Lake Tahoe as well. Public Works, under the leadership of Carolyn Berg, who has arrived, she worked with me on the Nacimiento Water Project, has begun, and we're investigating the actions that Lake Tahoe has been taking, and we've been sharing that information with Monterey Agency. Here at Lake Nacimiento, we have an important water resource that is managed under the jurisdiction of two different agencies. Slo County has land use authority. Monterey Agency has jurisdiction over the water body itself. While no specific legislative platform has been presented which would address either one of our agencies specifically in that regard, the general platform in today's action will, however, lay the platform to enhance our ability to do that in the future. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have in regards to this.
Thank you. There are a couple. Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hollenbeck, as you know, our Parks Department has developed a decontamination facility at both Lopez Lake and Santa Margarita Lake, so they can inspect the boats and decontaminate them if they feel it's necessary. And I'm curious to know if you've spoken with Monterey County about establishing facilities that would be available to people should they be bringing their boats in from outlying areas or whatever. You know, you spoke to the fact that you can't control all of the entry points.
Mm-hmm.
But is there an opportunity, say somebody is bringing their boat up from Southern California and they suspect that it might, you know, be contaminated, there's some place they can go to have it decontaminated before it's put in the lake?
Right. We have spoke to Monterey Agency about this. They recognize the challenge that they face, but they don't have any decontamination area set up just yet, but I will share with you what I believe they shared with us, and that they recognize the challenge that exists. The other thing we recognize is Lake Nacimiento, as compared to the rest of the water bodies here in the county, gets a huge amount of traffic. That doesn't mean ours don't get a huge amount of traffic either, but theirs does get a lot of traffic. They have a logistic issue, is where would they stage such decontamination, especially if you can pick out, let's say, the July 4th weekend. Where are all these boats going to pile up to be able to go get decontaminated? I recognize, too, that that is a challenge, but I recognize that anytime you have challenges, and I think it's just in my nature as a civil engineer, you find solutions to those challenges. And in this case, I think what you do is perhaps find land that is on the way to the lakes, and you create a brand new decontamination facility at that place. I never did hear Monterey mention that, but I think that that's a possibility. What I did hear them mention is car washes. They thought car washes could be utilized for people to go in, get washed down, decontaminated, and get an inspection sticker, decontamination sticker from the vendor of the car wash, and then proceed onto the lake. I don't know of any places where that would happen, but if we had the same logistics problem of decontaminating boats or watercrafts as they are at the lake or near the lake, I would expect the same sort of thing at the little, you know, in Tascadero where I live. All the car washes I know that exist there don't have room for 35 boats. They barely have enough room for 10 vehicles to be waiting. There's probably other solutions there. I haven't heard many of what they've shared with us other than those that I've just mentioned right now. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I was just curious because, you know, there isn't an opportunity to do it, even if people think, you know,
know, they're at risk, let's say,
right,
then it doesn't happen.
The other, exactly, the other thing that we did talk about, we had a meeting on June 18th, is billboards. Get billboards put up that identify that inspection is possible. That might then encourage those that feel that they maybe have been in a water body that contains mussels to either do self-inspection, self-policing. But my personal opinion on that is that if you don't actually inspect them, decontaminate them, or reject them and get them off the, you know, don't let them launch, I don't know where that, you know, the billboards are good, but I don't know that the billboards are the answer.
Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to comment on that very part of it, John. At the meeting that we had on the 18th of June, there was an indication that within 30 to 60 days they would have posted signage. Have we seen any incremental steps towards that? And then as a follow-up to the last comment, what I thought was important that we do is at least make people aware of the fact that there is a potential for your boat to be inspected by having signage that said boat is subject to inspection, because the logistical nightmare that was discussed, I mean, it's a reality. Because of that access point to the lake, if you can imagine traffic backed up on a three-day weekend trying to inspect boats, that takes about a half an hour to 45 minutes to go through inspection, that's a problem. So this isn't something easy that's going to be accomplished overnight, but incremental steps to get there, mm-hmm. One of which we thought signage would be a good thing to at least let people know, for number one, we're aware of the problem. Number two, you could be pulled aside and your boat could be inspected so that they know that this is coming, and then start getting the word out to let everybody know that this problem is going to be taken seriously, and at some point the logistical aspect of trying to find a place to do the inspections, I think we'll find that, but it's going to take some time to get there.
The signage has not been put up yet. They have taken actions though since our meeting on the 18th, and they submitted a draft of what that signage would look like, and we commented on that draft and sent it back to them. Our comments were basically try to erase words that you don't need to say, because as you're passing by a sign, you don't have much time to glance and look, you know. So, and Carolyn, do you know of any, have we seen any feedback from them? Have they addressed those comments yet? Okay. I asked Christine Halley, who works on our North Minute Water Project as a consultant. I sent her out on Highway 46 because she lives in Bakersfield and she comes in this way when she does business here. And I asked her to look for billboards. And, you know, usually at the bottom of them they give an 800 number and who owns the billboard. I said, write that down. Let's get that up to Monterey Agency. Christine's also called and found out how much it costs per month. It's actually a pretty reasonable price, I think, for such an important message to be put up. So they haven't put up Supervisor Meacham yet, but I know that we're headed that way. And I don't, June, July, August, we're getting pretty close to that 60 days, aren't we?
Right. Okay. So I wonder if I could ask about the authority that either the county or the Monterey agency has to work with some of the private entrances to the lake. I guess you got Oak Shores up on one side, you've got Heritage Ranch on others.
Running Deer on the other side.
And have project. I mean, so working backwards in a way, does the Monterey agency have the authority to prohibit access to the water if a vessel doesn't meet a certain level of inspection and decontamination?
I believe under the Fish and Game Code they probably would have that authority.
And
Fish and Game Code says that any anybody knowingly having an invasive species, it doesn't specifically say the mussels, but
I mean,
the operator of the system has that authority.
You know, I think for the thing for the public to know is the consequences of this contamination, if it should occur, are huge. It's billions of dollars nationwide. It's billions of dollars to this county's project alone, not to mention the rest of the works out there.
Right.
So I guess I'm wondering whether the agency has given any indication that they're ready to assert some authority to protect their water from that contamination, and then how does that ripple outward to work with the county to assert authority on the private property? I mean, presumably, we then have the authority via ordinance to assert, you know, certain requirements on private property, and, you know, of course, we've got funding, which is yet another. I mean, if you'd respond to where they are on that authority issue, then I have one other question.
I think it's an very, very early stage. I think the discussions began on the 18th of June. We identified that what jurisdiction we have, since the reservoir is within our boundaries, is land use authority responsibilities. They have, as the owner of the reservoir and the dam and everything, they have the authority to protect that water body. You know, if somebody wants, they asked the question, if somebody wanted to build their own private dock to dock their boat up against it, how do they go about doing that? Actually, I think we learned that there's not even a planning requirement to have that go through the planning. It just, you just do it. So perhaps I think you're right. I think dually we both take where we have our jurisdictions and we work cooperatively on how we go and get those ordinances or whatever the right avenue is in place so that we can better protect that.
Right.
They haven't, you know, they will hand out literature. I just learned recently from one of the members of San Luis Obispo, or I'm sorry, yeah, City of San Luis Obispo, one of their boating staff members said that they actually gave them something as they went through and asked where they had been. They didn't inspect or anything, but that is a big improvement over last year.
Yeah, and I think the educational component, I mean, I speak of ordinances because there's authority to do so,
sure.
But that's, you know, we have enforcement issues, we have, you know, education as likely the more effective way of accomplishing that. But I guess my other question is there any preliminary thoughts on a budget for actually getting a reasonable protection program in place, and do we want to say anything about that in our
sure.
Ledge platform?
They presented rough numbers to us. In the order of $400,000 to $700,000 of what they thought it might take to manage an inspection program at Lake Nacimiento. That did not include if you needed to build the logistics inspection place somewhere outside of the lake boundaries, I didn't include that. That was just their rough budget. They've also came down and went through a training session with our Parks Division out at Lopez Lake just last week, wasn't it? And I've heard from our Parks guys that originally they thought $200,000 is what it was going to take for the management of inspections at both Lopez and Santa Maria. I think now they're down in the $40,000 to $50,000 range. So I think that $400,000 to $700,000 is probably a large number that will get whittled down, is my expectations. They haven't budgeted for that yet. What we've done here internally to our county is we have $50,000 in Public Works budgeted so that Carolyn could, you know, stay on top of it with Monterey County. We think one of the ways to best improve Lake Nacimiento's situation anyway is weekly talk to them, email them, you know, communicate with them. The old saying, the squeaky hen gets the oil.
Pester them.
I told her I want you to squeak like mad.
All right.
And I think she's going to do a fine job.
All right. Mr. Sajid?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You touched what I was going to talk about, what San Luis has done at the entryway. It won't be as time-consuming if we had a flyer that will speak up the muscle, the damage it does, the responsibility of the boat owner, and fines if they don't do the right thing. Now, that can be given at the entryway without wasting any time, just like you're checking your annual pass or paying a fee. At the same time, you can be given an education piece that this is very important, put a warning sign on it so it takes their attention. And every convenience store within any lake should have a flyer posted that gets, and maybe with the cooperation of the cashier or whoever, that this is a serious matter for us, and please look at it. But billboards, you say it's reasonable. I always find them to be very expensive, but you know, it depends who's paying for it, I guess. And every now and then, if they pull a boat out for inspection, the way it looks wet or dry, whatever raises a flag, then that word will go out. But if they know that absolutely nobody's getting inspected and they want to have fun, knowing that if something was to be found on their boat that there's a fine and they will not come back for a period of time, whatever it might be, an ordinance in place will give you a little more teeth. I'm willing to work on that because the end result, it's very disturbing and damaging. I think we need to do some brainstorming as what we can do immediately with some flyers and paperwork and education. And then I would like to see an ordinance go in place. Otherwise,
what do you have to go with? Mr. Meacher?
Yeah, just a follow-up to your point, Mr. Chairman, in regard to the education aspect, and I think that that's absolutely key, is trying to educate folks into the detriment that this could create. I know that, interestingly enough, the major concern is not from those that live at the lake locally. It's from those that are coming outside the lake, and in some areas, certain size of boats are banned from other lakes because they can go to the bigger lakes that have these problems. So trying to get that information and trying to get our arms around all of the different aspects of how this could be dealt with and how it could be contained, the educational process has to start now. And I think the County of Monterey and San Francisco, they recognize the problem, and they're trying to incrementally get there. It's not going to be easy, it's not going to be cheap, and it's not going to be done quickly. But
a question, if I may, Mr. Chair. If we have an idea where are they coming from the radius, we can get through DMV all the registered owners' names and addresses, maybe a mail-out part of the education effort to all registered voters. Maybe something goes to their places of residence to pay attention.
And again, thoughts, and as we have a one speaker slip I'll get to here in a second, but also I wonder if both the county and the agency are coordinating with other state agencies on a statewide approach. I think what Mr. Shajan brings up is the fact that this isn't just our problem. It is spread in a variety of different places. I saw a documentary on Lake Mead, which positively floored me. What they do to the inside of pipes and turbines and other equipment is quite stunning. But it seems to me that we need to be working with Fish and Game. We need to be working with state level resources here to come up with some consistency. And again, the item before us today is a legislative platform. As we think about this, do we want to talk about in our plan? We certainly want to encourage coordination with other agencies, both local and state. But also, how are we going to fund this issue, and who should pay for it? So.
Exactly. In our 18th meeting with the Monterey Agency, we identified that, as a user of the water, that we would also expect to have a responsibility to help funding for that as well. They are the lion's share owner. Obviously, we would see them as a lion's share funder of it. But, support to be able to obtain funding through, state programs is, I think very important for this particular issue. I don't know the funding situation for Fish and Game, but I do know the funding. I read the paper. I know what our state's going through right now. There's a lot of hands out for funding to support good causes. And right now they look at a teeny tiny mussel. Maybe they don't see the impact of that. But you're right. The devastation that it does to piping and other things is horrendous.
So I wonder if we might add to the – I mean, I'm going to suggest to my colleagues we add to the LEDGE platform that we support funding the necessary prevention eradication by those who benefit from the resource. I mean, we could work on the words there, but I think we need to identify in our LEDGE platform that we expect those who either recreate or benefit from the water resource in other ways, whether they drink it or use it to fight off seawater intrusion, are those who should be looking to fund in fair share, or words to that effect.
User fees,
and however we want to craft it. I do have two requests to speak. Let me open it to the public. Michael Wynn, followed by Alon Perlman.
Good morning, Chairman, Supervisors. My name is Mike Wynn, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Water Resource Advisory Committee on this issue. I realize that we're looking at your legislative platform today, but the threat of the invasive species from quagga and zebra mussels here is very, very great concern to us. First, I do want to commend you and your staff for the fine work they're doing on Santa Margarita Lake and Lopez Lake. These are excellent programs. They've been highly effective. The fact that occasionally they do turn a boat away tells us the system is working, and we commend you and them both on that. Our concern is that in Nacimiento, the potential for undermining your investment in the Nacimiento Water Project, and not just the Board of Supervisors, but the cities that are contracted to take water, is a highly serious threat. It could undermine your entire investment. It could add huge costs on downstream if this invasion takes place. The problem, of course, in Nacimiento is much more complex than it is in the other two lakes. You have two different counties that are making decisions. That's always problematic. And the access to it is far more varied. But this has to be solved. It's simply a problem that's not going to go away. And bemoaning the fact that it's more difficult doesn't solve the problem. I urge you to give high priority to county-to-county communication and make it a matter of some urgency. Secondly, I urge you not to let the complexity of this make you slow down in any way. In fact, it needs to speed up. Third, we do need to find solutions. We must, I agree with Chairman Gibson, we have to have education. Education alone, however, is not going to solve the problem. So we need to do that, but we need to add to it. A couple of things might happen. Mr. Hollenbeck's suggestion, for example, of a site along routes to the lake is certainly something we could do. If we don't control the reservoir, we do control access. Secondly, we may need to limit some roads because of the emergency, the threat to health and safety, that these no longer become through roads. And this is complex. I'm not suggesting that this is a total answer, but that's part of the problem. Third, you might think about water docking or water storage facilities on the lake so that people who don't live on the lake but want to keep their boats there would have some facilities for doing that so they don't have to keep going in and out and being certified in and out constantly. I think these are issues. Even if you assume that our best efforts are doomed to failure, and if we're looking 50 to 100 years, I think that's given. Every year that we can postpone this gains critical time because there are bioremediation modalities that are coming on the line, ways of dealing with this on a permanent basis and a successful basis. Every year we gain is a good one. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn. Mr. Perlman?
Alan Perlman from Asosos. Mr. Wynn has actually addressed one of the points that I wrote down here, that is the threat to fresh water supplies. So I'll use part of my time to open it up to a much bigger picture, which is this is just one of many invasive species. We are looking at changes in weather. The changes in weather are going to, at least in the short while, it's already identified that there will be El Niñas, I believe, that will bring more rain, more moisture, actually, which is a good thing, at least in the short run, to us. That's going to open, there's been less travel, but the world has expanded its commerce and its transport of people and vessels, and so these threats are going to continue to come. Eradication is really not possible. Once you have the problem, you're essentially dealing with management. You're not actually going to be able to achieve eradication except in a few early instances. So prevention is very important. Unfortunately, education isn't necessarily the full solution here because education, at this point, it's quite possible 80% of voters are educated. If you increase that to 95%, that improves the situation, but you have to remember, a level of 1% non-compliance is going to establish these mussels in the waterways. It's just going to happen. I recommend, and by the way, the history of entry of the snakefish into American waters is a very telling situation because that was intentionally planted. On the smaller detail level is a tarp boat and in a foggy mountain pass necessarily going to allow the mussels to desiccate, to dry out enough to kill them. Bilge pumps, of course, are on boats. The biggest boats have bigger, more complicated pumps. On the other hand, tackle boxes, coolers, are sometimes transferred within the vehicles. So you have to be able to do a very high-level inspection, and I'm suggesting you that you be as restrictive as possible
And knowing that the budget is limited, use whatever you can create as a budget from user fees to then increase access. But one of the things that should be looked at definitely is not to punish separate dedicated boats where individuals are only using the one lake and they're transporting their boat back home. So I know this is all about the legislative process, but these details are important. Eradication is virtually impossible once a foreign species has established itself in an environment that it is adapted to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Perlman. With that, we'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board. Mr. Hombeck, I have a sentence to add regarding funding. I don't know if you had proposed something.
No, I wrote down briefly what you said, but I'd like to hear your...
I'd like to propose to colleagues that we add to the ledge platform a sentence following the ones in Exhibit A that says, support funding mechanisms that allocate the cost of relevant programs fairly to both recreational and municipal users of county water resources.
Is that a net?
So,
I'll let her record that, and then I'll make certain it gets picked up.
Would Madam Clerk like it one more time?
Yes.
That would be support funding mechanisms that allocate the cost of relevant programs fairly to both recreational and municipal users of county water resources. All right, any further discussion? Mr. Ashajian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Holmbach, part of our discussion to get the boats washed prior to getting to the lake and using the car washes as was mentioned. Are we taking the problem then from the public sector to the private sector?
Where
do they get washed to and what kind of damage they do on their way to the stormwater system? Or?
Well, it would have to be a closed system, obviously. We could not allow the wash water to work its way into the hydrology around it. You know, the little creeks and streams. If you were to take a contaminated wash water and let it work its way out of the boundaries of the car wash, and it got into a little creek nearby, you'll never get it out of that creek. If you did create a system to decontaminate that way, all waters that were utilized in that would have to stay on site and be treated. Now, there are chemical doses that will kill the mussels and their babies. It's a chlorine type of solution, and so you could build treatment facilities associated with that as well.
The reason I bring it up, if everybody rushes now to wash them at the rear everyday car wash as they're set up, we're not solving the problem. We're creating another problem.
The resources are the washes we have today. I doubt would you'd have to modify them in order for them to be utilized correctly. That the car wash idea came from Monterey County, and I'm not sure if they've heard that at some other place.
And one other thought, I didn't want to say idea. This can be a statewide problem. Mm-hmm. Just like you have the CHP who pulls the trucks off the road now and then to do an inspection of the kind, I wonder if they'll be, within their jurisdiction, now and then pull a boat being trailered around to ask the question if inspections were to be done or a visual inspection on and off. If that word goes out, and if they do that once or twice a week or a month, whatever, I think people's level of conscience will rise quite a bit. So if there's a room for us to work with our state officials to have CHP maybe putting in their efforts whenever available, as time permits them, I think that there's such a strong message there. Will make us think twice.
Okay, Mr. Meacham.
Just finally to wrap up here before we go on, but there are jurisdictional restraints in some cases by that suggestion by the Highway Patrol, and that was discussed at great lengths as well. But I can assure you that the County of Monterey is taking this very seriously, not just from a health standpoint, but from an economic standpoint. They recognize the economic benefit that that lake, that they derive from that lake. Supervisor Salinas and I have committed to stay in contact with one another to see if we can assist one another as far as progress on this. So, once again, this isn't going to be something that we're going to be able to take care of all at one time. It's going to cost, but I think the educational aspect of it is first, and I would support the addition to the legislative platform.
Okay. With that, we're ready for action.
Chairman, I move that we introduce on our 2009 legislative invasive aquatic species as per Exhibit A with the amendment proposed by the chairman.
Second. We have Mr. Meacham and Mr. Patterson. We do believe we can execute this on a voice vote. All those in favor, aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, none. And that concludes this matter. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Hallbeck, Ms. Berg. Appreciate it. Brings us to closed session. I have no request to speak on closed session, so we'll close it to the public, bring it back. Mr. Jensen, estimate?
About 60 minutes.
All right. And I would propose to colleagues we convene, say, at 11 o'clock?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you. Are we ready to go? Thank you. Madam Clerk, we'll reconvene the afternoon session. And as is our tradition, we'll ask Mr. Jensen for a report out of closed session, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Warren Jensen, County Council. The board did meet in closed session. No reportable action was taken.
Okay, thank you very much. Moves us to afternoon general public comment items not on the agenda. Show of hands on those wishing to speak on the Los Osos water or wastewater issues. 1, 2, 3, 4... Ms. Riley, on water, wastewater?
Duval.
On Duval, okay, thank you. So we have four slips for Los Osos and Ms. Riley on Duval. We'll start with Mr. Michael Robertson, followed by Piper Riley, please.
Is this the microphone here?
Yeah, just okay. Speak as if you're...
I am Mike Robertson from Atascadero, California, representing Slo Green Build here today. Most of you might know that Slo Green Build, Surf Rider, and the Sierra Club have been working in the community to educate building professionals, residents, business owners on the benefits of appropriate technologies. Last year, we held a gray water workshop by Art Ludwig, a low-impact development workshop by some of the local professionals in the area, rainwater harvesting by Brock Dolman. Jonathan Todd came and talked about bioremediation and different wastewater processes. We've been meeting with Jim Patterson over the last year, and he invited the Building and Planning Department, Health and Safety, some of these other different groups to help us guide us through what would be important in terms of really promoting these appropriate technologies. We started off with gray water, and we've developed a manual for the San Luis Obispo County on safe and healthy practices for implementing gray water. It comes at a very appropriate time right now. The California Building Standards Commission is in the process of potentially on August 4th allowing gray water in an unpermitted fashion. Now, this doesn't mean anybody can go out and do gray water any way they want. There are legal guidelines and specific ways which you must install the gray water. It's going to be a simple laundry system and potentially one other fixture, but it will not necessarily require a permit. Right now, Slo County, on your website, you do have a washing machine gray water system that you can get permitted for about $150, $180. But this will go beyond and allow people to do this essentially without a permit if they meet some simple guidelines. So it's very appropriate that this handbook is coming out now because we obviously don't want people installing gray water systems that aren't healthy and they don't meet safety and healthy. And so what we've done, we've talked about the do's and don'ts. You don't want to plant invasive plants and cause a problem there. You don't want to use detergents that will start ruining your soil and have salt buildup and whatnot. What we've done is come up with a series of recipe cards that residents can go in and essentially copy. and each one of these recipe cards does meet the building code as it's outlined right now for gray water. If you look at a recipe card, for instance, on the top, it will have how sustainable it is. Another will be, what's the complexity? How hard is it to install? The next is, how much does it cost? And then if you look, it has a diagram of the installation. It has some of the highlights of the technologies. It has an example of a calculation based on code. It has the installation process and a maintenance program. So I want to give this copy to Bruce Gibson as a representative to the rest of the board to share it, look at it. I've given several copies to Jim Patterson, and he's in the process of really helping getting the cities and the county to get this in circulation. So I appreciate all your efforts.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Robertson. Appreciate you. I think Mr. Patterson has a question or a comment.
Well, I just wanted to follow up on what Michael said, and thank you for coming down and letting folks know that this is coming. As Mr. Robinson said, I am working with water purveyors and cities and the county to make this information available, and hopefully within the next few weeks we'll have copies of these available through the planning and building departments and through the local water purveyors. We're trying to get them on board. Many have set conservation goals for the summer due to the drought, and this is one more opportunity for people to conserve water in their homes. So, Michael, thank you. It's an excellent booklet. Job well done, and we'll work with you to get it distributed.
Yeah, I'll add my thanks to both you and Slo Greenville for all the good work you're doing. Very important topic we've got going here. Ms. Riley, followed by Dr. Seahite.
Good afternoon, Board. I'm Piper Riley from Los Osos. This morning, my four-year-old daughter had a dentist's appointment but absolutely refused to open her mouth. You may remember her, Chairman Gibson. She was standing next to you at Thursday night's LOCAC meeting when the topic of conversation was the alarming disrepair of water management in District 3. Since my daughter's dentist appointment ended prematurely, I was able to hear some of this morning's session. Two main themes: the critical state of the water in Slo County, and the arbitrary and capricious nature of this board in regards to housing and humanity. You speak about a 10-year plan to end homelessness, but your actions show otherwise. It was ironic to hear a speaker ask, what are they supposed to do if Dan Duvall's doors are closed? Should they move in with you, Chairman Gibson? The irony of this is, our joke in Los Osos is, when hundreds, if not thousands, of people are displaced, are they to move in with Paavo Ogren? Unfortunately, homelessness, hardship, and harassment are not jokes. They are not funny. Why do you ride Mr. Duvall and ignore Roanoke Ranch and their substantial pollution violations? As a board, you have some really serious issues facing you: budget shortfalls, water supply, housing, public safety. Please stop business as usual with all of those sweetheart deals. Sustainability must be the first order of business if we are to survive as a society, and this must be adopted at every juncture. By making projects sustainable, they can generate local employment, keep people in their homes, boost revenue streams. It's time to be fair and to act for the greater majority and let go of special interests. As I've said before, we can be a shining example of how to do things right in the 21st century, or we can perpetuate what is wrong. Please, let's get it right the first time. In some places, we haven't. Santa Isabel, the fence around the skate park, the Celebrate Los Osos fence around the Red Barn, the fence around Tri-W. All blunders in Los Osos. Let's get it right the first time. Everything needs to be sustainable. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Riley. Dr. Height, followed by Julian Havangian.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos World Community Workshop. The wrong is overwhelming. I always advocate for the underdog because you treat those you consider the least in society. How you treat those you consider the least in society is the first indicator of how you will treat classes of people and those associated with classes of people. There is nothing an individual can do or say that justifies ignoring their basic rights. Nothing. Whether it's your former deputy administrator or the homeless at the Duvall Ranch. 40 displaced residents equals $40,000 a head in services expenses. You're not paying me as your ADA compliance officer, but while in drug recovery program, these individuals that are verifying that they are drug-free are qualified disabled people. You have 4 days to put your money to work that you just paid the Housing Authority to provide services to DSS, because DSS now must refer and write emergency housing vouchers for 40 people that are at risk of displacement and homelessness and relapse, which has really got to be serious. I mean, we're talking about potential death here, something very serious. The county will be negligent if they don't comply, if they don't accommodate, if they sit back and do nothing. You're not rewarding me to bring home ownership to Los Osos or the county, and I've asked you to, this in the paper, I've asked you to look into why county staff has yet to bring forth the information that HUD is willing to pay 70% of the expenses for first-time home buyers that is what's being paid on rent. There's really no difference. You could be owning instead of just paying out that money in rent. I have deep concerns for the status of women in this county, and you're also not paying me to prevent disability, shaken baby syndrome, postpartum depression, but I'm posting breastfeeding tips on my website because this is the responsible thing to do. There is a complete disconnect. There is a complete failure in the housing element and the transportation element, the status of women. We're in some very serious times, and we need to just focus on some practical concerns. You know, the people that are being paid by the county really need to click a mouse. They need to see what is available out there, and they need to bring it forth so the public can know about it. I believe in a separation of church and state, and I'm extremely disappointed. It's not going to fly. Eve made me do it. Jezebel made me do it. There needs to be equality in this county for women. They need to be free from harassment no matter what they do or say. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Height. Mr. Havanjian, followed by Gwen Taylor.
Good morning, Board of Supervisors. My name is Julian Havanjian. I'm an IHSS caregiver. And I'd first like to thank the Board of Supervisors and the county for all its continued support for IHSS. It's been well documented that the Board of Supervisors has supported this vital program in the past, and I'm here today to ask for that same support, continued support, for caregivers that take care of the disabled and elderly throughout San Luis Obispo County. The governor signed the revised budget bill this morning. The legislature voted on last week, and the cuts to IHSS are devastating and unacceptable. It's very disturbing how the state is turning its back on our veterans, our disabled, the elderly, the people who take care of them, and this isn't the end of the fight. June 23rd, 2009, last month, when all the IHSS caregivers and clients came here to the board, that very same day, a federal judge implemented a preliminary injunction to stop wage cuts to IHSS caregivers. More than 400,000 caregivers throughout the state of California, there's a freeze. So our wages were not cut. The federal judge implemented this. And, of course, the Schwarzenegger administration appealed it without success. June 29th, 2009, home care providers won. And our wages are still, they haven't been decreased. And it was a clear violation of the federal Medicaid law, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Rehabilitation Act, and this is just a temporary fix, and IHSS caregivers are going to fight this, and we would really appreciate the support from the county and the Board of Supervisors, which you guys have shown in the past, because there's some tough times coming ahead for this program, and we'd like the county to stand with us on this very important fight. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Havanjian. Remaining four speakers are on Los Osos, 2 minutes apiece. Madam Clerk, Gwen Taylor, followed by Al Barrow.
Good afternoon. My name is Gwen Taylor. I'm a resident of Los Osos in the Prohibition Zone. Once again, this board is being asked to place a moratorium on any development that withdraws water from the Los Osos water basin. Saltwater intrusion into the basin is exceeding the recharge with installation of hot tubs, vacation rental, vacationers who do not consider or give serious thought to what consequences there are to their actions, including but not limited to flush and forget. We need a moratorium, not mitigations. This would allow evaluation of the basin, initiate a basin management plan, and promote a strong conservation plan for the community as a whole now. The moratorium is justified for the immediate preservation of public health, safety, and welfare, and the protection of the only water supply for the Los Osos, our water wells. Action is needed now, not tomorrow, not next week, but now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Mr. Barrow, followed by Lindy Owen.
Good afternoon, Supervisors. Here are some quotes from the Coastal Commission's Director, Peter Douglas, the Planning Commission, and these were ferreted out by Dr. Mary Fulward's hard work. As you know, you do not have a project that will comply with the LCP at the moment. The Planning Commission is doing everything they can to build statements of overriding consideration to force this bad project through. And the Coastal Commission staff on March 25th letter says pump stations proposed to be located in Esha are not allowed under the LCP. Well, that's what a gravity system has to have, is pump stations. And I talked with Bubby down at his manager of the collection system here in town, and he said that would be a real issue, even getting them working right. The step eliminates 22 pump stations, many which are being designed at the edge of the state marine reserve. Since Prohibition Zone, homeowners are already familiar with the septic tanks and their maintenance. It's not a large leap to have septic tanks on the table or on one's property. Both step and gravity collection system installations will disrupt homeowners' property. The benefit of the step is to eliminate pump stations and so on and so forth. Step collection is 100% fused. We heard Commissioner Bruce Wyatt say, why is step off the table? It's sealed, that is the Planning Commissioner, sealed shallow trenches beneficial to the Chumash. And Wyatt said a step could work, and I don't want to rule it out, and so forth and so on. Chairman Sarah Christie, allow step to be a viable option with design build. Eugene Meschler, I would like to see the step is advanced if possible. Public Works Director Hutchison said that permit the project with the option of step. That is possible. So please, please listen to what your staff and what the Board of Planning Commission has said. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barrow. Ms. Owen, followed by Ben DePata.
Good afternoon. Lindy Owen from Los Osos, taking 50 minutes from my day to come in for my 2 minutes. I just wanted to thank the Tribune for the first information on the sewer in the last 6 months or so, and we actually got a headline that didn't talk about our streets not being able to be repaired because of the lack of a sewer. And in this, there is a statement. The big news was that Tonini is off the table. We don't need the spray fields out there, and it's a ridiculous place to put a treatment plant. And so that basically eliminates about half of the project. What's left to be discussed is whether we will get a chance to have a fair bidding process with a step system, which is innovative and sustainable, or if Mr. Gibson would like to prefer the flush and forget sewer, which is basically business as usual, the ones that are polluting the United States and other parts of the world because they don't have the potential that a step system has. His statement here was that he has publicly defended the site from criticism, and I will agree to that, and I want to ask him why he has defended it, because it never made sense, and the Planning Commission did a very thorough job, found a place to put all the water distribution. We now know that we don't even need the other disposal site at Broderson. What was distressing about some of those hearings was that Mark Hutchinson actually lied publicly to the Planning Commission by telling them that the sludge would be going to the Coal Canyon landfill, When county staff called the Coal Canyon landfill, they said, oh no, we would not be taking the sludge from Los Osos, and we have no plans in the future of taking it. So we have some problems with the staff that put together the $7 million proposal that we do not look at alternatives. I am begging you, the only way we're going to have a sustainable green sewer in Los Osos is if you let the two industries compete. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Mr. DeFada.
Ben DeFada and Los Osos, last of the good guys. You still don't get it. We all know that finding a solution for this wastewater project is complicated. But surely by now we should have been near finding a solution. If you five were running a corporation, you would be fired or the company would be bankrupt and the employees would be out of a job, just like in Los Osos, they'd be out of their homes because of the affordability of your stupid gravity biolactonides site in the spray field. We have seen that, I thought maybe somebody was coming after me.
No, sir, you're safe here.
We have seen that his solution is not the way for Los Osos. It is too expensive, not green, and is not a sustainable solution. We have known for some time that the water is a precious commodity that we have to conserve and save. What will it take for you to see what you are doing to this community? You have approved $7 million for studies that have been done in the past several times. Mr. Ogren and his staff were milking this project big time. Rep. Pacific did most of the work in less than 6 months at a cost of $500,000, and maybe another half to get it completed. But you all ignored it. Soon you'll be asking for several more $1 million. When will it stop? In January 52, I came here to the San Fernando Valley from Baltimore, Maryland. You want to hear what a coincidence that is? I used to play ball with Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi's brothers while my father and her father would be visiting in the Little Italy part of Baltimore. And what a thrill it was to come to California and be a part of the movie industry with this great weather and standing near some of my heroes. Point being, we love it here in California, especially Los Osos. That is why we are fighting hard to stay here. You love it here, and so do we. All we're asking for is an affordable, sustainable solution. Gravity Biolac spray fields is not it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeFada. That concludes general public comment for this afternoon. So we'll close it to the public and ask Madam Clerk to introduce our first item, please.
Next item is E1, consideration of a report on the county's option to petition to intervene on the Ostra Carrizo Energy Solar Farm project before the California Energy Commission, 5th District.
Ms. Carroll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Ellen Carroll, the Environmental Coordinator for the county. The purpose of this item today is for the board to determine what level of involvement the county should play in the California Energy Commission's future licensing proceedings and hearings on the OSRA solar thermal project. For the past year or so, Supervisor Patterson's office and county staff have been working fairly closely with the Energy Commission staff and also OSRA on this project. We've provided information and comments and recommendations to them. Both the Energy Commission staff and OSRA have been responsive and cooperative. However, there's still a few issues, important issues, that need to be resolved. And so at this point, we're getting closer to the licensing proceedings before the Energy Commission. And so today what we're asking is for the board to direct us to continue to negotiate with OSRA and the Energy Commission and try and resolve those problems. And then if we are not successful in that, then we're asking you to direct us to go ahead and become interveners. John McKinsey is our project manager on this project, and he has a staff report for you today, a short staff report, and then we'll be available for questions.
All right. Thank you. Mr. McKinsey.
Thank you, Ellen. Thank you, Chairman Gibson, Supervisors, John McKinsey. I'd like to just briefly just state the issue that I'm going to talk about. It is a quick overview of the project itself. The basic reasons of concern that the county has, summarize quickly the county service impacts, provide a brief overview of the Energy Commission's permitting process, and identify the advantages and disadvantages in becoming an intervener, and then give it back to the board on what direction you all would like to take on this. The OSRA project, the Carrizo Energy Solar Farm, is 177 megawatts of solar thermal power being proposed in the Carrizo Plains. The first part of the process will be a three-year construction period where they'll have about 300 daily employees. At the conclusion of the construction, once it goes into operation, there'll be set about 75 full-time employees. It's located on Highway 58. It's between Bitterwater Road and California Valley Subdivision, kind of in the easternmost part of the county. All of the permitting process will be through the California Energy Commission. This is a picture showing where the Carrizo Energy Solar Farm is located, as well as the other two projects that are being processed through the county, which is the Topaz Solar Farm and the California Valley Solar Ranch. Just the reasons for concern are briefly, the county, as I mentioned, has no permitting authority, so does not have the ability to require conditions be put on the project. A main concern is the state property tax exemption that was passed, which basically limits the amount of property tax that can be assessed for the proposed development. Property taxes are a substantial revenue source to help fund county services. Another reason would be the impact to county service from large construction effort over 3 years, as well as from ongoing operations. As I mentioned, there are two other large solar plants on similar time frames to be built, which would have a cumulative effect to the county. In addition, there is limited county resources to serve the area, and there are other potential non-fiscal issues such as visual, water, biological resources that are also a potential concern. County services that would be impacted include county fire, life safety. The closest station, several miles away, is a part-time facility where they have three full-time individuals for 3 days out of the week. Or I'm sorry, two full-time people, 3 days a week, and then a volunteer support in addition to that. Another issue is the connecting public roads. Highway 58 is the state highway that goes along the project boundaries. It has constraints, so we feel that there'll be a north-south connection with the county road, either with Shell Creek or Bitterwater, to connect to a better state highway, 46, 41, and we have concerns with the impacts associated with truck travel on that county road, those county roads. In addition, there's county code enforcement. There's potential for illegal camping during construction, given that there could be a workforce cumulatively of up to 1,000 people per day that will be commuting to and from the projects. And lastly, sheriff, there'll be increased responses from vandalism, traffic incidences, and the like, from mostly during the construction period, but on an ongoing basis as well. Just briefly, I'll touch upon the California Energy Commission's process. They call it, the first part of their process is kind of considered the discovery and analysis, where they look at all of the laws, ordinances, regulations, and standards, or LORs, that apply to any project within the jurisdiction that is being proposed. As a part of that process, they do conduct engineering and environmental analysis. They do an excellent job of facilitating the public and agency participation through workshops, and as well as providing information on the internet. The staff products, similar to our draft environmental impact report and our final environmental impact report, would relate to what they call their preliminary staff assessment, which they've completed, as well as a final staff assessment, which they're going to be completing in the near future. Then the staff makes recommendations to the committee. The committee, which is a two-person or two people from the full hearing body, then would take a proposed decision to that full hearing body. And this is just a graphic showing the players once it does get to the decision-making mode as a part of the, you know, or to the committee itself as well as to the full commission, showing that the county does have a seat at the table. As well as there's the intervener testimony also is another, I guess, a little bigger seat at the table. As well as public comment, applicant testimony, and staff testimony are all contributors to that decision. Why intervene? Assuming that we are unsuccessful in negotiating with OSRA and or the Energy Commission, the advantages, basically it provides a greater presence at the pre-hearing conference and evidentiary hearing. You can ask questions of the Energy Commission, as well as anybody else giving public testimony. You can file petitions, objections, and briefs. You can cross-examine any witness produced at hearings. You also will receive copies of all written notices expeditiously, which could be important at the very end of the process. Some of the disadvantages, it will result in substantial staff time being spent to prepare written documents and to meet noticing requirements. The ex parte or the direct communication with the CEC, the applicant, and other interveners that we currently enjoy would no longer be allowed. The county will need to modify relationships with Aspen, which is our environmental consultant, preparing the county EIRs for the two other projects, where there's several Aspen employees that are working both on our county project as well as acting as CEC staff extensions. So we would need to modify that arrangement. So in closing, we direct your board we ask your board to direct staff to negotiate with OSRA and the Energy Commission to ensure that the project's fiscal impacts to the provision of county services are fully mitigated. And in the event that a negotiated agreement on the fiscal impacts cannot be reached, staff is authorized to petition to intervene in the CEC proceeding. And that would conclude my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. McKenzie. Any questions of Mr. McKenzie? I'd offer Supervisor Patterson the first shot there.
Well, I have no questions.
All right.
Staff, no.
Okay. Mr. Meacham.
I do. Thank you. Ellen, yesterday we spoke and you sent me a little bit of information today. My question goes towards E119 on the summary of the impacts requiring mitigation and the dollars attached to that. And my question was, would this be set up in an account specific for these? And then you gave me that information. However, are these sub-accounts to that general account that will be applicable to the dollars attached?
Might be an admin office.
You know, Tim, can you comment to that?
Mr. Chairman and Supervisor Meacham, I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. The vehicle by which we would enter into an agreement, if it's an agreement, or enter into some sort of taxing mechanism, if that's what it ends up being, that hasn't yet been arrived at.
Oh.
And so we're not certain of the answer, but I can assure you that we wouldn't ever agree to anything that didn't manage to secure this money for this purpose and this purpose alone and no other. That would be the only thing that we would settle for.
So it wouldn't go into a general fund type account? Or
no. It would be dedicated to these purposes.
Okay.
And we could do that through a couple of different mechanisms. So we've talked about using the possibility of setting up a Mello Ruse district. We've also talked about simply entering into an agreement with these companies, this company or these companies, that would accomplish that same end.
Okay. And then I guess, and I don't know if it's appropriate, but with the other projects coming online, would that be joined in with some of these impacts that are being suggested here as far as total dollar amounts to be allocated?
Yes. What we've indicated in the report that's been prepared so far and in the very preliminary discussions that we've had with OSRA, the only company that we're currently talking to, is that we would attempt to equitably divide this burden among everyone who ends up becoming permitted out there. Now, obviously, at this point, we don't want to commit ourselves to permitting anyone other than OSRA, so we don't know how it's going to turn out. But our position is that to the extent that other things are permitted out there, that this burden will be shared by all of them.
So that would be in addition to these dollars?
No, it would be to some. What this report does to some extent is to attempt to identify a cumulative impact that can be shared. So some costs, for example, are going to be incurred whether you have one plant or three. Other costs are going to be greater if there's additional plants.
I see.
And so what we've done is to try to identify those two things and say, well, in some cases we need new fire personnel, whether there's one more plant or three more plants. But some things we don't need as much of, and for those there would be an economy of scale if there are more plants approved.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also on the Mello Ruse, and perhaps Mr. McNulty could
could answer this as well. Two questions. One is, and I talked a little bit about this with Ellen yesterday, can we begin to craft, despite obviously everything's tentative because we've just begun the CEQA process on the two PV projects that will come through here, and OSRA is going through CEC, but can we begin to craft the Mello-Ruse agreement with the three, or do we have to wait until they're each permitted?
If that ends up becoming the vehicle that we use, we can put it into place prior to making any decisions on the other two plants, and it can be expanded or contracted.
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Grant, County Administrative Officer. In regards to the Mello-Ruse, last week your board did approve an item that allows staff to work with a consultant to write the policies and procedures for that, so we'd certainly want to have that before we enter into any of this other type of financing mechanism at this point. But we can then use those policies and procedures to craft any Mello-Ruse district that we thought was appropriate.
Okay. And one further question, if I could, and this is regarding the impacts. One of the issues, of course, is that, as Mr. McKenzie spelled out, is that the projects are property tax exempt. A big portion of property tax for most projects goes to the school districts. Would that figure into anything? Obviously, we are not responsible for the school districts. I don't know if they themselves are intervening or that we would represent their interest in any way.
Supervisor Hill, at this point, we have not taken it upon ourselves to try to analyze what the impacts of the districts would be, and they have not intervened. We do know that that OSRA, in particular, has been in contact with the affected school districts, and they have been having discussions. I don't know how far those go or what they intend to get out of those.
I'll just elaborate a little bit. I believe there is a condition currently in the PSA that speaks to specific compensation for the school.
Okay. Thank you. That's all for now, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Shadji.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Seems like my questions were semi asked and answered.
With the mitigation fees in place and the impact of the property tax, which also helps us to pay for fire and sheriff and things of that nature, is this something that's is there a precedent within our state that where this kind of operation has been exempt from property tax? And why is it that maybe an incentive from the state or the federal government not to pay or get a discount on their income taxes rather than property tax, which comes out of our pocket, they're not impacted by it? If they were to get an incentive from the state and the federal government and leave us alone with our source of income, what's out there?
I think if I understand it correctly, this is an incentive for renewable energies to develop in California, and so that was the vehicle that was determined appropriate to provide that incentive was to eliminate this additional property tax.
That's our state working with our local jurisdictions,
yes.
Just like that.
Yes, right.
State legislation.
And that's why I'm questioning that. Why isn't the state giving them a break on their income, capital gains, operational income level, and to create this incentive in place rather than giving them something out of our pockets?
I can't speak to that, really. I can only say what they've approved.
Let's see if Mr. Seabach would like to offer.
Jerry Seabach, County Auditor Controller. I have one theory, is that when they originally passed the property tax exemption for renewables, it was thought that that was somebody putting a solar panel or two on their roof or, you know, something very small like that, and the wanting to encourage that, and so the property tax impact. They didn't want assessors running around chasing people down because they put a couple panels on their roof and adding value to their house because of that. That, you know, probably be minimal cost impact, but a plant like this is very significant, or can be. But it isn't the federal, it's the state, as Supervisor Asajian, I think, recognizes that it's the property tax is a state and local matter. Speaking of precedent, though, I have heard that there was the more recent round of geothermal power development in Sonoma County, and Sonoma was able to get some payments from, I think, just a negotiated process. I don't know for sure, but I don't think they formed a CFD, but they got payments to mitigate the and replace some of the local revenue that they would have had through the property taxes.
Any chance we get further information on that, Mr. Siebel?
Yeah, I think we should. I think that would be a good idea.
And I wonder if I could throw into the mix, I would have thought this plant might be subject to something like the unitary tax, that we don't get all of the property tax off Diablo Canyon. It would be nice, but we don't. And I would think that a large plant like this could fit into that system. Is there any consideration?
Well, not the way it looks. It doesn't look like the way the law is written now. First of all, these aren't going to be owned by PG&E, so these are contracted,
right,
perhaps, to PG&E. So it's not part of their unitary system. But also, it's pretty clear that it's a solar or renewable installation, and that's exempted by on the law.
Any other questions?
Yes, well, we have Mr. Seabock, if you wouldn't mind. Do you have an opinion, Jerry, on, you mentioned that what Sonoma done with the geothermal, whether a contract kind of approach with the companies to offset the impacts or a Mellow Ruse district of some kind?
Either way, I don't have an opinion. I think whatever you can get that has a guarantee that can't be reneged on, obviously, a good contract would do it, or the Mellow Ruse process, either one would probably be satisfactory.
Thank you.
But I hadn't done any research on the Sonoma. I think, you know, I should have done that, but when I heard about it a few weeks ago, and so I think we can continue working on that aspect.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions of staff at this point? I will open it to the public. I don't have any requests to speak, and seeing no one coming forward, we'll bring it back to the board and offer it to Mr. Patterson again.
Boy, that was a surprise. I expected a few people to at least be here and speak to this issue. I've gotten some feedback from constituents out in the California Valley area. Mr. Chair, if I may, would like to take just a couple of minutes to first thank staff, primarily Mr. McKenzie and Ms. Carroll from planning, because they have really been the lead throughout this process, communicating with both the California Energy Commission and the applicant. John McKenzie's really been the person in direct contact with them throughout the process. We participated in a number of workshops out in California Valley with the CEC and their applicant and the applicant's consultant. And we also convened a meeting in Santa Margarita on a weekend to make the information more accessible to the general public. And again, the CEC and applicant, as well as their environmental consultant, were very cooperative in agreeing to participate in that. And I agree with Mr. McKenzie that throughout the process, the CEC and the applicant have been very responsive, and we've had a good line of communication with them. When, in fact, we got to the physical services area and the preliminary staff assessment came out, it was wanting for information, really. We thought it was very poorly done, didn't fully address all the issues, and they actually suggested that we have direct communication with the applicant, see if we can't work that out. And as you all know, we did authorize staff to hire a consultant and take a look into these issues, and the result of that effort is provided in the staff report that we have before us today. And it's at that point that Mr. McNulty joined the effort, and he's been instrumental in working with the consultant, as have a number of other representatives from a variety of county departments, and you can see those all listed on page 5 of item E1. You can see that we had a lot of cooperation and communication and interaction with others to get to this point where we are today with the fiscal and service impacts. And staff's recommendation, I want to speak to a little bit and elaborate on. What they're asking us to do is to authorize staff to continue negotiating with the CEC and the applicant over the fiscal and service impacts that have been identified in the report. Ms. Carroll, Mr. McNulty, and I did travel to Palo Alto a couple of months ago to meet directly with AJRA to talk about these issues, and we've continued to work with the consultant, Town Hall Services, to generate this final report, which has been sent to the applicant, and we have yet to have any direct discussions with them on the report. What's important, I think, to realize is that we're beginning to get close to the end of the process, and we have some options here as to how we want to continue to interact with the CEC and the applicant. And what staff is asking us to do, again, is to continue negotiating with them regarding the fiscal and service impact. If we are unable to reach an agreement with AJRA, then staff is asking permission to petition to be an intervener. And keep in mind that the permitting for this project is not through the county, but through the California Energy Commission. And being an intervener is how we can best represent our interests before the CEC. And I wanted to point out a couple of things that were mentioned in the staff report. And again, my compliments to all of those involved in putting this particular staff report together. It included my legislative assistant, Amy Gelman, as well as Leslie Brown from ADMAN and Tim McNulty and John McKenzie and Ellen and others all working together. And I think they've described the situation very well. But there comes a point when everything comes back to the CEC and we're in their process. And we have to ask ourselves how we want to engage in that process. And the way they've set up the procedure is that they will have another workshop after the final staff assessment comes out. And the final staff assessment is the state's way of saying environmental impact report. So once we have all that information, they'll have another workshop, probably out in Carrizo Plain. And then they have their, what they call a pre-hearing conference. After that, and at the pre-hearing conference, I believe there's two representatives of the CEC there, where they review the final staff assessment. Then it goes on to the commission itself and the evidentiary hearing. And it's at that hearing where the commission, as I understand it, and Mr. McNulty, you correct me if I miss it along the way here, but the way I understand it is that it's there that they will actually review the final staff assessment, the CEC staff's report and recommendations. And they will also hear additional information from interveners and testimony from interveners. There will also be public comment at that hearing, but it's not considered evidence. Only those things from the staff report and the final staff assessment and information from interveners does the CEC consider. And so I think it's really important that we maintain the opportunity to be engaged in that process. And while the CEC says that they will consider local jurisdictions, in our case the counties, input, they are by no means obligated to do that beyond just public testimony. So what I want to be sure that we're aware of and that we're ready to move forward on is that in order to maintain our ability to participate fully right up to the point where the CEC makes a decision on that plan is to become an intervener. And Mr. McKenzie outlined briefly the advantages, disadvantages, and the obligations. That's all spelled out explicitly in the staff report. And then this afternoon at the hearing, he spoke to that as well. There's a timeline approaching by which we have to declare whether or not we want to intervene or not. I think it's important to point out that we have to meet that deadline or we don't have the opportunity. It's also important to point out that while the staff report speaks specifically to the physical and service impacts that are defined in the report from Town Hall Services, that there are a number of other issues and concerns that I have and that people out in the Carrizo have and we should be aware of. All the information is not in on those yet. Again, we're waiting for the final staff assessment, but they include the traffic issues that Mr. McKenzie alluded to, water noise, visual impacts, and the biological impacts, specifically those, or especially those that relate to the sensitive wildlife resources out there, both habitat and the migration corridor. And there's a study underway now to determine the potential impact on those wildlife species. It is not necessary in filing to be an intervener that we identify the issues that we're concerned about. We simply say that we want to intervene. And my thought is, and we have a new update that just came in on the timing of these additional workshops and hearings that are being planned. It's looking like it'll be sometime in September before we actually have to file a petition to intervene. So my recommendation would be to adopt staff's recommendations 1 and 2, but also to direct staff to prepare a petition to intervene. And when the deadline is known by which we have to apply that, and we will have much more information available by that time, that staff comes back to the board for direction and authorization to file the petition to intervene.
Second.
And
thank you. We have a motion. We have a second. You're killing me.
I wanted you to get the flavor of it.
I have a question if I could, too.
Actually, you have a supervisor, yeah. Shajian, under discussion. The motion. I'll take that as a motion.
I assume you intended thereby,
and I assume Madam Clerk.
I thought I was just being thorough.
As it just you were. I know thorough. Mr. Shajian.
I know the timer said 2 is 2 minutes. Talk, I guess.
That's for you.
No problem here. Patterson, I mean, agreement about going with item 1 and 2, but why doesn't that on its own allow the staff to intervene as we move forward rather than expect them to come back with a petition for another approval?
Well, the way it's worded, that if we're able to work out an agreement with OJRA, then there would be no need to intervene, but
right.
My point is that there's a lot of other unresolved issues out there that we may well want to intervene on.
And I'm saying, yeah, go for it.
Okay.
So, yeah. Why complicate it? Just give them that carte blanche that if we don't come to an agreement, then they're authorized to intervene
Right, but if we do come to an agreement, are they still authorized to intervene on all these other issues?
Sure.
Well, you know what? My preference is that you never want to miss the boat. As an intervener, you always have that. You have a step into the door, and when you need to open it wider, it's available. Otherwise, it's not. So at all times, I'd rather be an intervener till the final.
Well, and with my colleague's prompt second to the motion, agree.
Thank you.
You know, and I'll take that and appreciate your support. I think it's important to realize, though, that we don't want to do that because of the limitations until we absolutely have to. We want to maintain an open door and an opportunity to make direct phone calls and talk to staff and so forth right up until the time we file the petition, because once we file the petition, there's no more ex parte communication.
There is a second. Do you want another second?
Is staff clear on the direction, I guess, is the question. If they are,
they're asleep.
Call for the...
crowd here this afternoon.
I think it all started this morning.
We're not really asleep. I just wanted to make sure. So it's adopting the recommendation, and then what I wrote down is direct staff to prepare the petition, and when the deadline is known, staff would come back to the board for direction to intervene.
Well, the sense that I'm getting,
are you taking that part out?
The way the recommendation is that if we come to an agreement, then we don't intervene. I'm just what I'm hearing from my colleagues is let's prepare the petition to intervene, and when the time comes, we intervene and we'll address the issues as they come forth.
But let me get Supervisor Meacham's question out here.
Yes, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to intervene in my colleague's dissertation on the Osher plan on intervention. But one quick question, maybe Jerry, you can answer this. What happens if this plant no longer continues? Does this go back on the tax roll?
Okay. Give me the question again, Supervisor.
Because remember the Arco Solar out there, they're no longer in operation.
Right.
If there's a tax benefit to this, a property tax issue here, if they no longer are in operation, does this revert back on the tax roll?
I would think so, but probably at a greatly reduced value. Now, we have an assessor person here that could speak with a little more authority. I'm remembering the old thing just sitting there.
Right.
Of the old thing would have been almost nothing.
But the county doesn't collect, won't be able to get property tax off of this. Is that correct?
Let Lisa.
Okay. I'll ask the pro.
Lisa Goforth, County Assessor. Can you re-ask your question?
Well, they have a tax benefit by putting this energy plant in place. We're not going to receive property tax from them. Is that correct?
We will receive some. We will be entitled to any change in ownership on the land and anything that is not part of the photovoltaic system. So if they build shop buildings, if they build roads, if they build fences, anything like that, in my understanding of what's written right now in the law, we would pick that up. Normally, the state board would do an energy company's plant in the unitary tax, but it doesn't work in this situation.
So I guess if this plant ceased to exist in terms of its ability to produce whatever it's doing, and it just stops, and it becomes not in existence anymore, does that go back on the tax roll, the entire properties?
We would never be able to pick up any of the solar production equipment. We would still maintain a tax base on the land and any improvements unrelated to the solar production.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Goforth. Mr. Jensen.
I was meeting a couple of months ago with State Board of Equalization staff, and they alerted me that actually this exemption for property tax on solar only applies to the original party that installs it, and that if there's a change in ownership, then the exemption goes away.
That's what I was thinking.
So, I have not verified that, but these are senior people at the State Board of Equalization.
My caution about it would be if it wasn't economical for the first builders to run it, it might not be economical as a solar panel for anybody else, so the valuation would be a lot less, even though we might get some.
But if it did change hands and it did change the type of an operation, it became more...
If they changed it to something that wasn't a solar plant, then I would think that Lisa would put it on the roll at whatever that was.
Okay.
I can't imagine what it would be.
Well, I'm not trying to complicate
things. We clarified that when we intervened.
Yeah. The other thing to think about is that if it's over a certain megawatt, which this is, I believe the State Board of Equalization would assess it then, and so then it's completely out of our control.
As long as it's, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for that learned discourse. Let me, at great personal risk, attempt to, seeing the mood my colleagues are in, attempt to clarify the motion. Let's see if this goes with the motion maker in the second. We could make the motion to adopt staff recommendation number one about negotiations. Second point is we could direct staff to prepare a petition to intervene. And third point would be to file that petition unless all issues are resolved before the deadline.
Mr. Chair, my only question about that motion, and that's sort of what I was thinking too, was without some sort of measuring device to tell us whether or not the other issues have been resolved, the fiscal issues are pretty black and white. We either get to the numbers we've identified or we don't. The other ones are as you can imagine, much more fuzzy.
Right.
And we probably, what I'm thinking is, if the direction I heard from the board was go ahead and file a petition to intervene, go ahead and negotiate the fiscal impacts, and we'll come back to you and figure out which issues we really need to engage on post-intervention at the point where it's appropriate
right.
to do that.
But I think, but my understanding from the staff report is that there's benefit to continue without intervener status because the negotiations are more fruitful, simpler, more direct. We'll go with the negotiating position, but let's plan to file a petition to intervene after we've exhausted all
okay.
potential negotiations.
Yeah, because I was going to say, if you did file the intervention, then everything else off the table, then you become
then,
part
then
of
you, then you go into this much more
exactly.
formal dialogue. So if it were, you know, and again, we can turn back to Mr. Patterson if he wants to modify the motion, but it sounds like we're headed toward intervener status to be sure that we have
right,
the ability
right.
to resolve those issues.
Right, and as Mr. McNulty mentioned, we will need to have further discussions about the issues as we get the final staff assessment. We know what all the information is, but I think I want to be crystal clear that we don't want to file that until the deadline arrives for us to do so, so we maintain open channels up to that point.
Would you like to restate your motion and see if we can get it reseconded?
Mr. Chair, can
sure,
I ask
sure,
a question?
Sure, sure, sure.
Yeah.
Why do we want to wait for the last minute?
The advantage to waiting is that once we intervene, then we are a formal party to the proceedings,
right.
and we are subject to the same restrictions on our ability to communicate with the CEC staff and with the other parties as we would be in a regular proceeding. So every letter that we send has to be copied to everyone, it has to be posted, et cetera. So the ability to have informal conversations with the applicant and the CEC staff that we've been having for the last few months will go away.
I'm just afraid of human error, that you can always intervene and withdraw, but once the deadline is passed, you cannot intervene, and so that can
but
be...
But if we intervene now, we're out of
we're,
the...
I can assure you that we're watching that intervention deadline very closely, and it's something that we've been aware of now for a few months, and we're trying to track it, you know, on a weekly basis, and we're in very close contact with OSRA and the CEC staff, and we're looking at all the markers that would tell us that we're close to that deadline, and we're trying to keep... pretty close track of it.
We'll just direct staff not to miss the deadline.
That's
yeah, part of the motion.
And so I'm comfortable with the motion as you defined it. Mr. Chairman, the items, item one, you know, which was...
Definitely item one. There's no confusion about that. So
right.
What about the petition to intervene? Does the board expect the staff to come back here prior to filing a petition to intervene or not? That's the question.
I would say no.
Okay.
So we could stick with the recommendation.
Okay. And then, so let's see what the clerk has and see if we can all agree on that.
Okay, I just got confused by what Mr. Hill said.
Well, I think it's 1 and 2.
I think it is 1 and 2.
So we're adopting staff recommendations.
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay, let me just ask one more thing. The way number 2 is worded,
right,
if we were to reach an agreement on fiscal impacts, we would not intervene.
Right, and
that's the reason for the confusion.
Okay, so let's modify 2. In the event that a negotiated agreement on all issues cannot be reached, staff is authorized to petition to intervene. Staff?
Give them, yeah. You good with that, Jim?
Well, yes, but, you know, again, as Mr. McNulty pointed out, you know, that how do we determine whether or not an agreement has been reached on, say, traffic or wildlife or, you know, some of these other issues?
Well, listen, but before the intervention deadline gets near to passing, we'll be back here to say, this is what we've come up with, you know.
Okay.
But at least at this point, we know it won't pass without our intervening. So.
Right, and you are preparing the petition then?
Yes.
Correct, okay.
So, all well and good that County Council is clear. Is Madam Clerk clear on the motion?
So we're adopting 1.
Yes.
We're modifying option 2 to remove fiscal impacts and put in all issues.
Correct.
And are we adding that staff will return before they file the petition or not?
That's simply staff direction, I think.
That's implied.
So without formal. All right?
Okay.
You good on that? We'll do a voice. All in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? None. All right, thank you very much. I know this is a complex process.
Thanks for the jam.
You guys are cold this afternoon.
There's a lot to it.
There is.
You have a stiff neck, Jim?
What's that?
You have a stiff neck, you're done.
Let's, we'll go ahead with an introduction of the next item, even as we know that it's even as we know that we have a recommendation to withdraw here.
Well, no, I can't prepare.
Is that all right? Was that off?
That was already.
Was that removed from the agenda? I think we should.
Just have introduced it.
Yeah.
We'll restate it.
Right.
Okay. It was discussed under the core agenda, and it's not actually withdrawn. It's continued to August 18th.
Okay, that's, we need a motion to actually do that.
Yes, sure.
So
we did that this morning with
the core agenda.
Yeah.
No, I think there was some confusion, but let's go ahead and introduce this. We'll formally act on it. We'll open it to the public too.
We have C3, which is a hearing to consider an appeal by Marilyn Farmer of the Planning Commission's approval of a conditional use permit, DRC 2007-00135, Sanjay Gonpule, for the construction of a 24,800 square foot medical office, parking area, landscaping, and associated improvements located at 1310 Las Tablas in Templeton, First District. It's recommended denial of the appeal.
So, Mr. Hogue, can you just tell us where we are on that?
Yes, Warren Hogue, Department of Planning and Building. We need to not hold the hearing today and instead hold it on August 18th because of a noticing error.
So we'll look, and I'll entertain a motion to continue in just a second, but because it was a noticed hearing, I will open it to the public.
Actually, it
no.
wasn't a noticed
it
hearing.
It
was
yes.
never
All
noticed.
Right. All right.
So we don't, Ms. Griffin just corrected me, we don't need to continue it, we just need to acknowledge
okay.
the hearing will occur on
okay.
August 18th.
So because this item was not properly noticed, this item will be heard on August 18th, and no further action is required at this point. Well, that's clear. Thank you. All right.
Sorry about that, Mr. Chair.
Not to worry. So, Madam Clerk, are you ready if you'd introduce our last item, Madam Clerk?
The next item is C4, a hearing to consider an appeal by Bonnie Vancara of the Subdivision Review Board's approval of parcel map CO07-0069, a proposal to subdivide a 135-acre parcel into two parcels of 72 and 62 acres at 7835 Estrella Road, southeast of San Miguel, First District. recommend a denial of the appeal.
All right. Ms. Kavanaugh?
Thank you, Chairman Gibson. Elizabeth Kavanaugh, County Planning staff here to represent this project. This is an Vancara appeal of a Porter parcel map. Staff is recommending that you affirm the decision of the Subdivision Review Board based on the findings and conditions in your packet. Our site is located off Estrella Road, right sandwiched between Estrella Road and Estrella River. The site is located in an area of agricultural zoning and use. And I'll be patient and wait. Would you like me to start over with the graphics?
No.
No? Okay. Here is an overhead of the site. This is the parent parcel and the two lots to be proposed as a subdivision. This little lot here was an illegally created lot that will go away with the subdivision. This lot, this parcel map, and this staff report talks a lot about easements, so I wanted to point out right up front the two easements in question here. The Rolette easement is part of this flag lot here, and it's here in red. And then the Vancara easement is this yellow line that runs across the Porter parcel map site. And before we get into the appeal issues, I just wanted to throw some definitions of words that were in the staff report, just for clarity. Access, meaning the vehicle, and these are straight out of the land use ordinance, meaning that it's the vehicle entrance and exit to a site. An easement is does it a legal right to use someone else's property. A right-of-way is really a description of a width on a document, usually for roads and alleys and utilities. And a street is what is being called as a public road that provides means of access. And why I felt that was important was because there was some words that I thought need a definition, because we're talking about what our subdivision or real property division ordinance refers to as a street versus an easement, and what requirements are relied upon if it's a street or relied upon if it's an easement. So I hope I'm not acting as if you don't know this information. But the main issue of this appeal is the reading of this section of our real property division ordinance. And it's the statement that private easements can serve as access for no more than five parcels. And that's what the applicant is appealing mainly in this appeal statement. The applicant subdivision did request to use the Rolette easement as its access to Lot 2. When we were processing the subdivision request, we looked at that, and keeping in mind that rule from our real property division ordinance, we counted parcels that were using access based on the definition of access in the land use ordinance, the vehicle entrance and access onto the site. So we counted those along with the public works and our legal department. And the crosses here in brownish are the ones that we identified as having and taking legal access off of this easement. Subsequently, as the appeal came forward, the appellant was able to provide an easement for this lot, that they do indeed have legal access down the Rolette parcel. So we counted that one also for this appeal discussion. That makes a total of five lots, including the proposed subdivision lot that will be using this easement. In light of the new information, we still feel that we're within the guideline of five lots taking access to this easement. Now, the applicant has a different point of view, and this is a map that reflects the lots that they feel that take access off of this easement. And that is partially, and as you can see, the brown ones here are the ones that staff has acknowledged that, yes, they do have legal access to use this easement. And then the white ones are the additional lots that the appellant feels has access to this easement. And I'd be glad to go one-on-one on these lots. The first one that's being disputed is this lot right here. There's currently no building on there, but this lot has frontage along Estrella Road, and so that is will be their primary means of access. This next lot here could, if they were allowed, if they had an easement, could have used this Rolette easement. However, they, if you can see this driveway, have taken it off of Estrella Road, so we didn't count that one. The Porter, one of the parcels of the proposed subdivision, has frontage along Estrella Road and takes access off of Estrella Road. This little lot that I pointed out earlier that is going away with the subdivision will no longer need access, so we didn't count that one. Staff never thought to count this one. The address is a River Road address. There's a pretty well-marked road that leads to the house on this parcel. So that one did come as a surprise. This is the appellant's parcel here, and they do indeed have an easement that runs along the Porter parcel. It runs east-west onto this piece of property, this chunk of their lot. But they have not verified to us that they have an easement along the Rolette easement. And so they're stating historically they have used this access and that they have a right to continue to use it. And that is, in essence, the main purpose of the main argument of this appeal. Although there's several issues outlined in the staff report, I think you've found, if you've read it, it goes back and forth to that main purpose, that main issue. There is one other issue, and it was relevant to another section of our real property division ordinance. It is section 2103010D1, and this is the language of that section here. And it's stating that, yes, new streets or existing streets are necessary, that they need to be 40 feet wide. And again, that refers back to streets, and a street being defined as a public road that provides mean and vehicle access. And so staff determined that, again, this was a Rolette easement is being used for access for this parcel, and that this particular section was not relevant to the easement in question. So I know this is complicated, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have. Staff is recommending that you affirm the decision of the Subdivision Review Board and approve this project based on the findings and conditions before you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cavanaugh. Mr. Meacham.
Just quickly, if the county were to grant an easement, a 40-foot easement or whatever the case may be, would that be the responsibility of the county to maintain that?
If your board was to direct us to make that a public right-of-way and to open it up to the public, yes, it would be our responsibility.
But if I could jump in on that, I mean, there's a question about making it a public road. There's a separate question about making it a county-maintained road, and maybe Mr. Marshall could expound on that for a minute.
Sure. Honorable Chair Gibson, Supervisors, Glenn Marshall, the County Public Works Department. There's a couple of different steps. When Public Works looks to do a referral, if a road is necessary for area-wide circulation and it meets the criteria in the Title 21, then we would ask for an offer of dedication. Because there's an offer of dedication doesn't necessarily mean it's in the county maintenance system. It's a two-step process. One is for your board to accept that offer, and that would make it a public easement. And then, again, you could accept that offer into the county maintenance. You could accept the road into the county maintenance. So initially you've got the offer, which is nothing until it's accepted by your board. It can be accepted either as a public easement, not in the county road maintenance, or as a road maintained easement. Did I do that right, John? Okay.
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
All right.
Hopefully that made sense.
I'm sorry. Recognize Supervisor Sargent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is our legal responsibility when you have a piece of property that's surrounded by a river and it can be their only access, but otherwise it's a deadlock? Where do we come into the picture?
Well, I would like to defer to our county council to answer that question.
Jim Orton from county council. This is, there's an entire parcel here, a portion of which is...
Can you put the aerial picture on for me, please?
A portion of which is east of the river, and my understanding is that that parcel has access from from the west side, and that the appellant is in litigation against Mr. Porter with regard to an access easement across Mr. Porter's property to the east side of the river. But that parcel does have access, the entire parcel.
Is there an existing bridge?
Excuse me?
It has access to the from the main river road, but how about this smaller parcel, which if you can put your, right, that one there, is there any, you say they have access from it?
Well, they're claiming that the portion that's east of the river, they don't have access to unless they come across the Porter property. That's what the appellant is claiming.
Okay.
But I believe that her property has access on River Road on the west side. If you look at page 4-5, figure 3, it shows the River Road on the west side, and then it shows the river in the eastern portion there that is cut off. That they claim they don't have access.
Right,
but
I don't see any access there. Unless you build a bridge over the river.
No, they're in litigation, Mr. Porter, and claiming they have access over a private easement. And they were asking that there be an offer of dedication of a public easement across this property.
Let me go to my other question, even though I apologize I wasn't getting it. Existing easement that was in yellow previously, and the yellow here was red. Right. Now, that is only for that portion of the property, but there is no exit past that yellow line.
Yeah, this is approximate, but yeah, the easement starts on Mr. Porter's property wholly, and it does not exceed, and it goes through Mr. Porter's property onto the Vancara's property. Now, this whole piece of land is one parcel.
I understand that, but this seems to be left out because of the river coming through.
Yes.
And what, I'm sorry, what is the zoning on this smaller piece?
The whole area is agriculture, okay. All the parcels in question.
All the parcels in question, is it in operation as we speak for ag use?
I believe they're doing some grazing. The paperwork that I just handed out, or that was handed out, was some information that was provided to me this afternoon.
So summertime, cows can go across the river. There is pretty dry.
Well, but there's a big bank. I don't know how good cows can climb up that bank. It's pretty steep.
Yeah, goats maybe could. Yeah, but I wonder if I could go ahead with your question because I think. You asked a question that I wondered a bit about, and let me see if I can rephrase your first question, is does the county have any legal obligation to provide access to all portions of someone's parcel? I think what Supervisor Shajan's noting is the river seems to cut off a piece of that parcel. Do we as the county, in considering this land use application, have any responsibility to assure access to a piece of the parcel that's cut off by the river?
I don't believe so. I think that there's a requirement in our ordinance that we provide streets that are necessary for circulation in the neighborhood, and I think Public Works and Planning have addressed that.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
I'm done, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Excuse me. With that, and seeing no other questions, we'll go ahead and open it to the appellants and the applicants in our standard format of an appeal. We'll give the appellant up to 10 minutes to present information that they wish us to have, followed by 10 minutes for the applicants. And if there's anyone in the public to open it to, we'll open it to general members of the public after that. Excuse me.
Good afternoon. My name is Shauna Sullivan. I represent Bonnie Vancara. She and her family have been longtime residents of this county until she married a man in the military who wound up in Afghanistan. Now that she's come back to live on this property, she inherited two parcels. which comprise an 80-acre parcel and a 280 parcel. She's denied access to her property. And we're not talking about access just on the Porter property. The neighbors to the west have also denied her access. So we're involved in this litigation trying to resolve access issues. She's been denied access all around her property. And it's become a problem that we've brought litigation, unfortunately, to resolve, having tried to resolve it amicably for a long time. Their property, can you get my pictures up by any chance? Yeah, that's all that's on it is pictures.
Are these the ones that you provided us,
yes,
Ms. Sullivan?
We have copies
of those in front of us. We can go off those.
You'll see a parcel called Nicholas Parcel there. That is the parcel that is across the river to the east of the river, west of the river. I think I have my west and my east, right? And that parcel used to be owned by the Worthens, then it was sold to the Porters, then it was sold back to the Worthens. They swapped it back and forth. A lot of easements were created, and the Worthens acquired a number of easements. That's why on that one map, there's that one yellow easement they talked about or showed you earlier. And if my pictures, you can see it in my pictures. But there's a number of colored different segments of the easement. And that's because there were several various grants. And there was a grant from the Rowlett's predecessor in interest, which was Smith. And that was an easement to Gene Porter, who then deeded it to the Worthens. So there's a whole slew of easements here, and that's why there's lots of little pieces to it. The 20-foot piece was deeded to the Worthens, and it did exist, and it's been used historically as easement to access that 20 to 30-acre piece over there by the river. So the Nicholas piece, you can see where the road goes, the Nicholas piece in here, but the problem is that road's really not accessible. And there's a picture there I've shown you trying to go straight downhill on it. You can see that you can't get farm equipment through that. Something that's really, and you can see the bank and how we have a problem here of the river and quite an elevation there and too steep to go up. That's the Nicholas house you can see on that picture. The fence line you see there is to keep the cattle in. This property, which is about 20 to 30 acres, is agricultural Williamson Act property. It's CUP property. It's grazed. It's under contract. If you'll go to, there's the CUP contract designations. All of her property is agricultural. Surprisingly, the staff report made a statement that there's been no historical farming of this property, which was very curious because Mr. Porter had a 10 or 20-year lease with the Worthens to farm it, and he farmed it for years, that piece right there. And I provided to you a copy of the correspondence confirming that that property was farmed by Mr. Porter while the Worthens had it, and also the correspondence with my client about continuing to farm it. It was only after my client came back from Afghanistan and his wife and their family moved back here, and they found that they couldn't get access because their easements were all gone. Well, they were there, they just were being denied the access, that they found that that Mr. Porter was farming that piece of property. So when they asked for rent, then everything kind of blew up after that because he'd been farming it for a while and didn't want to pay rent, I guess. So that there goes the easement dispute that we are now involved in. There is, I don't know why staff didn't see this either, but there's a well. There's a permit for that well. There's a well test report I provided to you. There's electricity to that site. In answer to the question about access, there's really no way to get to that piece of the 280 parcel unless you go through Porter's parcel, which is historically how Gene Porter, his mother, always went through and how it's been accessed. You can't get down that cliff otherwise, particularly with farm equipment. The property, as I say, is under CUP contracts, and the Department of Agriculture has some very strict guidelines about grazing. Cattle have been on that property, and it's been farmed. And I know Mr. Porter, I believe he grew alfalfa on it, for years. So it's somewhat disingenuous for him to say that county records, or for staff to concur that county records show no past agricultural use of that property, when it's clearly ag use and it's also permitted with electricity and with a well. So we have this historical chain of title, which I provided, but it surprisingly is not in your packets because I provided staff at the very beginning of this when we realized the notice was about changing this to no dedicated right-of-way. And I sent a copy of the complaint to Ms. Cavanaugh, and I would like to have the administrative record include that complaint, which has the deeds and the chain of title. And we're asking the court to decide that title issue. We're not asking you to decide it. But I am asking that this board follow the law of what's required before approving a tentative map, and it requires that if there's a parcel that is being divided and you have five or more parcels to access, not primary access, just access, using the right-of-way, then you have to have it offered for dedication, and it needs to be 40 feet to 50 feet wide. Now, we're not so concerned about 40 to 50, or even we're okay with 20. We just want to make sure the adding is done right. If I could get you to put my next picture up that has the... What I'd like you to do, if you add, you will see these up, you will see that the Porter has three parcels now. So you have to count three accesses by Porter. He's got three parcels. He's going to access three places. That's three. Then you've got McClenny, Rigoli, Isaacs, Kennedy, Nicholas, and my client, which is eight. So you've got nine parcels accessing off that road. You cannot, or I don't believe this board can really realistically say it's only primary access, because that's not what the code requires. The code says that access, and D1 talks about primary access, but D7 does not. And so under your own land use ordinance, I think you have to find that they've got to make an offer of dedication. And I wanted to bring up there this acreage of my client, which is 20 to 30 acres of farmable land. If you deny the access to it, you've lost and decommissioned that much agricultural land. Mr. Porter is claiming, well, if I have to put a road in on my own property, I'm going to lose 2.2 acres. Well, I think denying any right to use the agricultural piece of property my client has certainly outweighs Mr. Porter giving up 2.2 acres of ag land to provide the access, which he should be providing, not his neighbors. I would like to ask that the documents I provided to you, as well as the complaint and my correspondence with Ms. Cavanaugh, be included in the record. I've got some of that here. I don't think it's up to this staff to determine whether we have an easement or not. It's the court's decision, but as I say, it is your decision to determine whether you're going to comply with the land use ordinance that requires five or more parcels, requires dedication, an offer of dedication. And in answer to an earlier question, the offer of dedication would just be an offer for dedication. It wouldn't create a need to be improved or anything by the county until the county maintains it. And then lastly, as far as road maintenance goes, since our client is an owner, and it would make no sense that she would just have a piece of going across a field that didn't connect to anything. That's just unrealistic. So obviously she has an easement, and I'm sure our lawsuit will show that in the end. So I thank you for your consideration. Do you have any questions for me?
Thank you, Ms. Sullen. I see no questions, so appreciate that, and we'll have another 5-minute segment here if you need it in just a second. I would invite the applicant to have a slip from Mr. Porter identifying himself as the applicant, a 10-minute segment to present your side of the story here.
Sure, thank you. Good morning. My name is Dean Porter, and I'm the project applicant in this matter. I'd like to use the overhead here.
Sure. Bill, I think we're going to have to get the gooseneck mic out of the field of the camera as well.
Go ahead and restart.
Do I need to do something else here?
Oh, maybe. No.
All right, since we're here to talk about a road today, I'd start out with a picture of the road we're talking about. And this is the road here. And what I thought was important here is I wanted you to see this is a very safe, open, high-visibility road. It's not a windy, over-hill and dale-type road. This private access easement is more than capable of handling the current and future needs of our neighborhood. Since there seems to be a dispute in the number of parcels using this road, I thought I'd quickly address the number of parcels that are using this road. This should be rather familiar by now. This is the project road that we're all talking about, this 20-foot easement road, and then this is Estrella Road. The problem that we have with the appellant, or that I have with the appellant, is if we start with this parcel right here, this is the parcel that I currently live on, and here's the farmstead. And this parcel, or parcel one, has three current accesses to Estrella Road. It doesn't have any connecting access to the project road, or the private easement road. This farmstead, or Eddie Mike Farm traffic, doesn't use the project road, has no way of using the project road to access Estrella Road. If we go to this next, and this, by the way, is one of the parcels that the appellant counts, and it's simply incorrect. This here I have parcel one. This is a 40-acre parcel. As Ms. Kovanoff pointed out, this has a half a mile of county road frontage. There's no connecting roads to the project road or to the easement. It doesn't use the easement. And more importantly, it doesn't have legal right or access to use this easement. So our contention is this should not be counted. Next one we have is called the parcel. It's another 40-acre parcel here. The farmstead is right here in this location, as Ms. Kavanaugh pointed out. It has a driveway that accesses Estrella Road right here. It does not have any connecting roads to the project road, to the easement road. And more importantly, it doesn't have any legal easement or rights to use that road. So we move on. Parcel 3, we all agree Parcel 3 uses the road. That's one. Parcel 4 uses the road. That's two people that use the road. Parcel 5 here is counted as using the road, and we have no dispute with that. However, I'd like to point out that 100% of Parcel 5 is a primary floodplain, or the secondary floodplain of the Estrella River, and is also on the liquefaction hazard zone map that the county provides. So this is not a buildable parcel. So as far as having any kind of vehicular traffic located with residents, associated with residences, this isn't going to happen. Parcel 6 owns the road, does not have to provide access to itself. Parcel 7 is my second parcel, and there's no dispute that will use the road. And then the one that I'd like to talk about a little more is this parcel 8, known as the Nicholas parcel. And historically, years and decades ago, it had access across the river, the Estrella River, when my own family owned it. Right now, it has a different access where it gains access from River Road. It also has a River Road address. And this is This is a copy. This is a picture of the current Estrella River crossing for the Nicholas parcel, and I'm trying to demonstrate that we all agree that the Nicholas parcel has legal easements to Estrella Road. However, it doesn't use it and hasn't used it in over a decade. And evidence of this, it crosses the Estrella River, the sand wash here. This is another picture of the driveway after you cross the river. It's obvious that this road and access is not used. It's not a CDF approved road. It's got a grade in excess of 30%. The current access for this Nicholas parcel is off of River Road. It's a 50-foot grant deed easement. And I think what we're here today is to find out how many parcels are really using this road. I think that's what's important here. And the Nicholas parcel does not use that road to gain access and hasn't in a long time. Could he start up a dune buggy and get across it? Yeah, he could, but I don't really think that's what we're here to discuss today. Is we're really trying to find out is whether this road can handle the amount of traffic that we're going to put on it. As was discussed, this is a matter under current litigation. We disagree that just because I don't think the county has any obligation to provide every county parcel with 100% access to every acre of land. I have on my current ranch here now, I have a 7-acre parcel over here that's on the other side of the Estrella River. And I access that for farming purposes. We drive a tractor across the river. And so I haven't gone over and tried to sue the Colieros to gain access through their property to access a little small portion of my ranch. So I don't think the county or anybody has any obligation to see that every acre of land on a parcel is accessed. And also, the pictures that were shown of this bluff, and there is a steep bluff, but there's an agricultural road that in this Van Carroll parcel that it has been used historically to access this field for farming purposes, and that road is still in place, and it can accept farm machinery, and trucks have gone up and down it, and it was resurfaced and regraded just within the last several years, so it is a maintained road, and it's been around for nearly 30 years. What the dispute is in the lawsuit is that my neighbors and I contend that there is no historic use for these roads. As the appellant pointed out, it was me that's farmed this for the last two decades, and the appellant's clients never did use any of our ranch roads to access their property. To say that I somehow could be responsible for whether or not they farm some of their fields is absurd. The appellant's fields are not farmed because, number one, they're absentee owners, and number two, they placed a parcel in the CRP program, which I'm sure you know is a voluntarily federal program where you're paid a yearly per acre fee for not farming. So they have the choice and the whereabouts and the access to farm this through their own parcel should they choose. It's their choice that they're not farming. So it's my contention that there's only 4 parcels that use this road, not 5, and so we have some wiggle room there, some comfort room that we have less than 5. So I'd also like to point out to the board that should your parcel count somehow or another exceed 5, that you have the authority as delineated in Title 21, Section 2103.020, to adjust the requirement of the project road to the existing 20-foot private access road as recommended by the Public Works Department, the Agriculture Department, and the staff report. Considering this project specifics versus the permanent loss of statewide important farmland soils, I believe that this would be the best choice, that we leave this easement to the 20-foot easement that we currently have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Porter. Any questions of Mr. Porter? Seeing none, I'll open it to other members of the public who are interested in speaking. I have no requests to speak and no one coming forward. Typically under this situation, we do give the applicant and appellant time for closing remarks, and it would go in the reverse order. So I don't know, Mr. Porter, before you leave the area here, you had anything you wanted to add since you ended 30 seconds ago or so, I'd be happy to hear.
Well, yeah, I'd just like to add that I think that this the road that we have here is well suited for the project. One of the big things, it's very rare that the Ag Department is on board for this, and the Ag Department is supportive of this project. And one of the reasons was that we went to great efforts to use the roads that were already available in the neighborhood, and we felt that they can handle the project, that we didn't want to make it a 40-foot road and take valuable land out of production, that the road there is ample. And even if by some the appellant's lawsuit against my neighbors and I has no merit, even if by some stretch of the imagination it goes through, the 20-acre parcel, or not parcel, the 20-acre portion of her parcel this would access is also 100% in the secondary floodplain, and it's also in the liquefaction hazard map zone. So there won't be any building or any houses down there. So even if she was somehow or another allowed to use that road, it's still not going to exceed the design capabilities of the road that we have there. And I would just encourage to keep things how they are. And I think that's one of the strong points of this project, is we are using the existing road with the blessing of the trustee, of the owner of the road.
Thank you, Mr. Porter. Ms. Sullen, concluding remarks?
Yes, I have a question. Put this one picture up. Go ahead. Oh, sorry. Would that work? Okay. About that. That picture is a better picture of how inaccessible that road is, and to then cross the river to get over to farm that property. I wanted to clarify a few things. One is, the CRP contract that's on this does have allow grazing, actually. I think it requires it. And it also is for erosion control. As you can see from the topo information I provided you, it's a pretty steep grade. And so the Department of Agriculture has required certain things to be done by the Vancaras to assure that erosion control is maintained. I wanted to point out also that when Mr. Porter pointed out his, I think he called it a farmstead, obviously equipment's going from his farmstead to go down the road to farm his parcels. So the equipment, obviously there's more than one parcel using the road, because he's going to be taking equipment from his farmstead to get it to the fields on the farmstead parcel, as well as the parcel next to it, and they're using this road. But again, it's not a matter of who is using the road, it's what parcels can access it. And as you can see, there's 9 parcels that can access and use that road, or historically have used that road. And, you know, the other thing I want to point about this picture was, I believe Mr. Porter claimed you might need a dune buggy to get down it. Actually, you do have to have four-wheel drive, and you can't get farm equipment down that. As far as the streets, there was some comment about the streets being different, but I think if you look at the ordinance, which applies to, it's 21.03.010, it says a tentative map must include D1, which is putting in access, or D2, or D7, private easements. And streets is not defined differently than roads under that ordinance. So I really ask this board to please compel this project to be conditioned upon meeting the requirements of the ordinance for providing an offer of dedication. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan. That will conclude public testimony on this item. We'll bring it back and offer staff a chance to respond to any issues that they feel need further comment.
Elizabeth Kavanaugh, County Planning Staff. I just wanted to point out that staff feels that this is within the guidelines, within the requirements of our Real Property Division ordinance, and that the 21.03010 does specifically call out streets need to be within that 40 to 50 foot right-of-way. And I think that's part of the confusion in this process, is streets versus easements. There's a whole different realm of requirements and sizes and materials and whatnot that govern each one. So just wanted to clarify that difference, and I'm okay. Available for questions you may
have.
Very
good. Thank you. Bring it back to the board. Offer the district supervisor first comment here?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, I think.
Got all that straight now.
Yeah, most difficult. But I guess the concern that I've got with this in some respects is that with this river, we have this situation all up and down the Salinas Corridor at various intervals, the way that I've seen it. And it appears to me that reading everything over, and I spoke with staff about this yesterday, that the Subdivision Review Board, they made the findings necessary to affirm their decision. So I'm comfortable with their choice in this. And it's unfortunate that we have this situation, but this river is going to dictate that as it goes.
Right? Are you don't have any other lights on? Are you want to?
I will make,
put
I'll
that
make
in
a motion. Yes, sir. I'll make a motion that we affirm the decision of the Subdivision Review Board and approve parcel map CO07-0069 based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and the conditions of approval listed in Exhibit B.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Mr. Shajian, speaking to the motion, I will support the motion. I think there are a number of interesting and vexing legal issues that probably will have to be resolved before a judge, but in terms of the basics of our land use ordinance, I think staff got it right in terms of counting parcels that take access off this easement, and relying on the testimony of Mr. Porter as to which parcels have legal access, a legal right to the easement, and those that don't, what parcels will go away and what parcels won't, I believe that the count is proper, is properly made, and the land use ordinance is satisfied.
And one other thing, if I might, Mr. Chairman, and maybe staff can clarify this too, there's no further subdivision proposed or anything that can be done in this particular area, is there?
No, sir. That was considered in the determination.
Okay. That said, and seeing no other requests to speak, Madam Clerk, we'll ask for a roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Asajian?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. And that concludes our business for the day. We are adjourned.